Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
I'd like to call our joint meeting of the House and Senate Transportation Committees to order. I'm State Representative Frank Hornstein, and I'm the chair of the House Transportation Committee. I'll be chairing the meeting today, and then when we go over to the Capitol next week, my colleague Senator Dibble will be chairing that meeting. So we have just a couple of housekeeping issues that we wanted to go over first, and I'll call on my colleague Senator Dibble to do that, and then we'll go right into the testimony. Senator Dibble.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you everyone for turning out on this pre-session hearing. This turnout is very, very impressive and probably speaks to the level of intensity, focus, and attention there is to transportation, the looming issues that we're going to hear a lot about in some detail at the federal level, and the opportunities that we have at the state level to continue the work that was started in 2008 to fuel our economy, the role that the 2008 advances made in helping us recover from the Great Recession. So thanks to everyone. Very impressive turnout from the House. I think senators operate on Senate time, so we'll see them drifting in hopefully soon. Although thank you to my colleagues who are here, and my minority lead Senator Peterson especially. The only housekeeping items, Mr. Chair, I wanted to announce at this point were that folks should know that we're on TV. So if you want to say hello to your mom, you're welcome to do that. And we have a whole bunch of handouts in your packets, members. And so for the folks who are viewing, all of those handouts are loaded onto at least the Senate committee, or is there a joint? The Senate committee website has all these handouts loaded onto them if folks want to pull those up as the testimony is occurring, or if they want to review them at some future point, or if you want to throw away all your stuff, not have a big pile of paper, you'll have access to everything that's in your packets electronically through the Senate website. That's all I have for now, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Senator Dibble. And we will go right into the hearing. I think people know each other. We're familiar with our colleagues in the Senate and House. But when people do have questions, please introduce yourself, for the committee and for the benefit of the public and our colleagues. And thank you. Very good turnout from the House. I appreciate that very much. Members and the public, one of the purposes of our hearing today is to get an update on developments that have happened since we were in session last spring with regard to transportation funding at both the federal and state levels. We will hear today about the challenges that we face at both levels of government, and as you know, it is the state with assistance from the federal government that is mainly responsible for funding our roads and bridges. Obviously, there's a local piece to that as well, and we'll be hearing a little bit about that. But the big bucks, as it were, come from Washington and St. Paul. And there is something in common that both of these levels of government have right now, and that is significant fiscal challenges. To use the term fiscal cliff, I think, would be accurate. What we're going to hear about today, members, is that there's a fiscal cliff at both the federal and state levels that needs to be addressed if we're to not only maintain but expand our road and bridge infrastructure in the state of Minnesota. And so we're going to hear about those challenges today. At the federal government, we're going to learn about the Highway User Trust Fund and the its current solvency issues. And at the state government, we're going to hear about the challenge that we have with bonding authority and other issues. So there's a slight change in the agenda. We wanted to start with our federal report. We'll start with Brian Palish and then Darrell Turner, and then we'll have MnDOT Commissioner Charlie Zelli kick off our discussion about the state. So I'd like to call up Mr. Palish from the American Society of Civil Engineers, who's traveled from Washington, D.C., and you got us on a relatively mild day. We've had it's been a lot worse. It's been a lot worse. Anytime the high temperature is above zero, Mr. Palish, we're pretty pleased with that. So I met Mr. Palish at a meeting in Washington last fall. I was very impressed with his presentation to a group of transportation committee chairs that had gathered from around the country. Some of you are familiar with the American Infrastructure Report Card, but Mr. Palish's organization authored that and has some updates to it. And so he'll present a summary of that, and then we're going to talk with Mr. Turner, who is with the Minnesota, he's the Minnesota Division Administrator of the U.S. DOT, for some more information about the Highway User Trust Fund. So with that, thank you again for traveling to Minnesota. Welcome to Minnesota, and welcome to our joint hearing.
Thank you very much. And I would say it's been a little cold in Washington, too. We seem to get the remnants of what you're getting, so not quite 5 degrees or zero, but and as a native Californian, this is cold. I will admit that. I will say this is cold. Good morning, and thank you all for having me here. As Mr. Hornstein said, my name is Brian Palish. I work for the American Society of Civil Engineers. Those of you that don't know what that is, ASCE is a national professional society. We've got about 145,000 members who are professional engineers and student engineers, et cetera. We have about 1,600 members actually in the state of Minnesota. We see ourselves as stewards of the nation's infrastructure. Civil engineers are responsible for the design, the construction, operation, and maintenance of our vital public works. With that responsibility comes the obligation to periodically assess the state of infrastructure, report on its condition and performance, and advise on the steps necessary to improve it. We do this in part by compiling what you guys have in front of you, which is the report card for America's infrastructure. This past spring, ASCE released our 2013 report card for America's infrastructure, which we've released every 4 years, morning, Ms. Hausman, since 1998. This is a comprehensive assessment of the nation's major infrastructure across 16 different categories. We use a very simple A to F school report card format. The report card provides an in-depth assessment of the current infrastructure conditions and investment needs. As you can see, America's cumulative GPA rose slightly to a D-plus from our last report card in 2009. Six sectors actually showed improvement because of increased state and local leadership, private investment, and a short-term influx of federal dollars. However, that D-plus is certainly not a cause for celebration. Our underperforming infrastructure is a drag on the nation's economy, leading to a lower GDP and fewer jobs for American families. The report card highlights the fact that, like everything, infrastructure has a lifespan. Good maintenance can extend that lifespan, but not forever. And a lack of maintenance can shorten it, and that is not something that happens dramatically overnight, but it gradually worsens over time. Far too many of our infrastructure systems lack the funding needed for proper maintenance, and we continue to see categories that are simply not seeing the improvement that are necessary for long-term economic growth and to improve that day-to-day performance and save money in the long term. The backlog of projects to maintain and modernize our infrastructure simply keeps growing, both at the federal level and at the state and local level. Our grading criteria includes a look at the condition, the capacity, the funding, the future need, operations and maintenance, public safety, resilience, and innovation. And in almost every category, as you can see, there's work to be done. Since the first report card was issued nearly 15 years ago, the grades have been near failing, averaging only a D due to delayed maintenance and this underinvestment. Think about this. More than 40% of our urban highways are congested. That means we as Americans waste almost 2 billion gallons of gas every year. And at last year's prices, folks spent more than $7 billion on gas idling in traffic. It also means that folks sat idling in traffic for 34 hours longer than they needed to. I'd note that in looking at the local area here, Minneapolis-St. Paul, you guys are right at the national average of 34 hours. So I don't know if that's something to be happy about or not. Washington, D.C. is number one, as I like to say in these presentations. I grew up in Los Angeles, where we were number one for a long time. Finally, 25 years after being in D.C., I'm back to number one. So and not something I'd like to be. 32% of our roads are in poor or mediocre condition. This costs all of us who are driving on deficient pavement over $300 per driver in additional repairs and operating costs. Probably a little bit worse this winter, as we've had. I know in Washington, D.C., we've had a pretty bad winter, and I've hit more than a few potholes. I'm sure you all have done the same. In Minnesota, though, I will tell you that number jumps to 52% of pavement in poor or mediocre condition. You all in Minnesota rank 38th in pavement quality, with more than half of the state's highways and 35% of its bridges more than 50 years old. While the nation has seen improvement in pavement conditions due to this short surge of investment from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, those were not sustained or long-term investments. As you can see, the grade for bridges went up slightly as states took the lead in reducing the number of structurally deficient bridges. However, in the U.S., we still have more than 66,000 structurally deficient bridges. That's 11%, or 1 in 9. Of note, 22 states actually have a higher percentage of structurally deficient bridges than the national average. However, there's good news in Minnesota. You guys are bucking that trend, if you will, and you're doing better than the national average, with only 9% of the state's bridges being rated structurally deficient. That's still, though, 1,100 bridges, so that's a lot of bridges. America's rail sector also saw the most improvement in our report card, moving from a C- to a C+. That's really because the freight rail industry is actually investing its own private sector money in advancing the needs for rail in our nation. Transit continues to be a problem. Transit's grade stayed the same as a D. What we're facing at the national level is aging transit systems that are not spending enough on operations and maintenance, while also really not addressing the true needs of the country. More than half of our nation's citizens don't have access to transit, and those that do say they don't have proper access or the right kind of access. The 4 years since our last report card have demonstrated that our infrastructure problem actually can be solved if we have leadership that commits to making good ideas a reality. In our 2013 report card, we estimate that across all 16 categories of infrastructure, the total investment needed is approximately $3.6 trillion, and that's a national figure. After the estimated likely spending, things that we think will happen just because that's the way things have been going for the long term, if you will, we feel that number, the shortfall, becomes about $1.6 trillion. That's about $200 billion a year. And that's, from our perspective, what we need to reach a grade of a B. So you might ask, why do these grades matter? Obviously, we do this so it's a little bit of an easier way for folks to understand why we should be investing in infrastructure. You all here probably have a much better, I know you have a better sense of that from sitting on this committee. So why do the grades matter? What does that D-plus really mean for the nation? We have found that America's infrastructure grades have an impact on our bottom line. Whether it's an inland waterway system, roads, transit system, or the electrical grid, America is connected by infrastructure. We know the consequences of neglecting these issues play out every single day. As I said earlier, we waste hours sitting in traffic. Power outages become more frequent, and we lose billions of gallons of water through leaky pipes. These impacts cost us all money. Prior to releasing the report card, we completed a series of economic studies trying to figure out what would happen if we didn't start investing to close this gap. We called those studies our failure to act studies, and they showed the opportunity cost that America is now facing if we continue to let the grades lag in the C's and D's. These studies looked at the current funding levels for major infrastructure sectors projected to the year 2020 to see what, if any, effect these will have on household incomes, jobs, GDP, and trade. What we found is that if we continue on the same path of underinvestment, and be clear, we are on a path of underinvestment, we face the following national effects by 2020. A projected loss of $3.1 trillion in GDP, which is about the equivalent of the GDP of France. A $1.1 trillion decline in U.S. trade value, which is the equivalent of Mexico's trade value. A loss of 3.5 million jobs in the year 2020 alone, and I want to make that point. Some of these are cumulative effects. Those are the jobs lost in 2020 alone. A $2.4 trillion decline in consumer spending, which is comparable to the GDP of Brazil. And then finally, the thing that's most troubling, I think, is this drop of $3,100 in disposable income per year per household. And we say disposable income because, as the economists explained to me, and I'm not one, so they had to explain it to me in small words easily, is what happens is we're not. It's not that we're losing income; it's that we're actually having to spend money that we normally spend disposable income on things we can't. We don't choose to. So, for example, when you hit that pothole and you break your axle, you have to fix your car, right? You can't just leave your car sitting there. So you fix your car instead of using your money for something else that you might want to use it for, which is a personal for the family, that is a problem. And while these investment needs might seem daunting, the real story of this report is that we can't afford not to make those investments. When our roads prevent trucks from getting from point A to B and deliver goods, we suffer. When blackouts turn off the lights of businesses, we suffer. When our ports can't keep pace with the realities of international commerce, you can't get stuff down the Mississippi River and out through the port of New Orleans, we suffer. When it hurts our GDP, it hurts the ability to create jobs, our disposable income, and frankly, it hurts our competitiveness with other nations. Deteriorating and aging infrastructure is not only an inconvenience, but frankly, it's affecting all of us every day. So as we look at this from ASCE's perspective, we've developed a number of solutions, and I'll go through those quickly. First, we need increased leadership. I think you guys are demonstrating that right here today by having this hearing. We need bold leadership and a compelling vision. Second, we need to start thinking about things in a more sustainable and resilient fashion. That's sort of my engineering type solution for these problems. But the reality is we need infrastructure systems that can withstand extreme weather. As we're rebuilding this infrastructure, if we're going to spend these trillions of dollars, we need to rebuild this infrastructure with an eye towards sustainability to make these components last longer, to make our infrastructure work better for us. And finally, we must agree on how to prioritize and plan strategic new investments in infrastructure that position our communities for the future. A D plus means a little bit that we have a long road ahead. At the federal level, we've started that year-long countdown to the expiration of the Federal Surface Transportation Bill, which is known as MAP 21. We face a pretty significant problem there with the Highway Trust Fund. It is going insolvent. That doesn't mean it's going to run out of money. It means that the ability of the federal government to reimburse states for projects is at minimum going to take a year off if the Congress doesn't do something, which is, I think, what you wanted me to get to, Mr. Hornstein. Yeah. And that problem is currently not exactly being addressed in Washington, I would say. I think I can say that safely from the state capitol here today. The trust fund will be insolvent, and really what that ends up meaning for that 1 year, there will be no obligation limits, if you will, for states. There will be no spending in Minnesota of federal dollars for 1 year. The state will get money to reimburse the current situation. So if you're letting projects now and you're going to pay them out, you'll get those funds back. But to get the trust fund back, if you will, to a more solvent level, if nothing happens, there will be $0 being sent out, if you will, on a new basis from Washington. My understanding, the recent understanding that I have, and I think this has been changing, is to fill the hole, and the hole will need to be filled in Washington, and it's going to have to be filled in this budget year, meaning the FY15 budget year, so the one looking forward, is about a $13.5 billion problem. And the way MAP 21 was set up was that it needed to be filled that year with money from that year's budget. It can't be sort of something put out into the future, and that's a little bit of the troubling part. $13 billion, even in Washington, is a lot of money. Especially in this sort of budget scenario that we're facing. We've already got the high end, the top line budget number put out for the year. That was agreed on back in January, if you all recall, or December, when the President and the Congress got together and agreed on that number. So now we're looking at a way and trying to fix that. It doesn't appear at this point, although I'm willing to be wrong on this, that new revenue is part of the discussion at this point. A lot is being talked about, but that seems to be a little bit shaky in terms of something that is going to be at least utilized this year. It's an election year in Washington. You all may know that. And so that makes things a little bit trickier. As I said, though, there is no silver bullet to addressing this problem. I would make that clear. Unless we address the backlog, though, of projects, we're really just going to continue to charge the American public money that they don't realize they're already paying. Right, I mean, at some point, you don't really realize that the 34 hours that you're wasting in traffic actually costs you in some other amount of time. Time you could spend with your family, time you could be spent doing other things, not to mention the wasted gas and all these other activities. So in closing, let's be clear. Our roads and bridges and transit systems and the other infrastructure systems, they are the foundation of our economy. They connect our businesses, our communities, and people. They drive our economy and improve our quality of life. For the U.S. to be competitive in the world, we need that world-class infrastructure system. In the short term, we need that national commitment to bring the existing infrastructure into a state of good repair. And in the long term, we have to modernize our infrastructure and build it in a strategic and targeted manner to address things for the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Palish. And then we have time for a few questions. We want to get through the hearing as quickly as possible. So we'll take a few. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to know if there's anybody here in the audience from the Minnesota Chamber and or the business partnership. Would you raise your hand if you are here? There's one or the other.
Do you have a question for the testifier, Representative Earhart?
I am not.
Okay. All right. I think. Okay. We'll go. We'll do House, Senate, House, Senate.
Thank you, Mr. Palish. One question I had for you. I appreciate all the work that the ASCE did on this report. Certainly, it's extensive. But did you guys give any state an A rating by any chance? And who are those states?
Any state grading? We did not grade states. We let our local groups grade their own infrastructure. Not to call out my Minnesota folks, but they have yet to do that. But I'll let them know that you think they should. We have state report cards in a number of states. What we did in this report card is we have some extensive information on, for example, the state of Minnesota. So I have a bunch of statistics on the state of Minnesota. I think I've got a copy. I'm happy to leave that with you. I'm happy to forward you a copy. It is available on our website in that form.
Representative Bornstein, just to follow up, what I was trying to get a feel for is which states are doing the best job in the country, and what type of grade do you think they got? Did they get is everybody a D or are they a C? With a D plus, in my mind, you know, if that's an average, there's a lot of Fs and there's only a lot of Cs. So,
you know, I guess I would say it depends on the category, right? And I hate to answer your question with being a little bit obtuse, but it really depends on the category. For example, in Minnesota, I would say you're above average. You have 9% of your bridges that are structurally deficient. I know that may not sound good, but really that's better than average for the national level. Pennsylvania, 24.7, or I think it's 24.7. We'll say 25 for lack of knowing the exact number. 25% of its bridges are structurally deficient. They're not doing as well in the area of bridges. I think it's sort of a category by category. I will say this, and I know Mr. Hornstein, you know this, Ms. Hausman, you know this as well, and some of you all may know this as well, but a number of states in the past year have taken this transportation issue and sort of grabbed it by the horns, if you will, or however you want to say it, and they've started to address it themselves. We saw 10 states this last session, so in the session before this, who did something to address some of their transportation problems. Wyoming, Virginia, Maryland, Vermont. I think it was Vermont. And I'll miss one, so I'll stop, and I won't get a state wrong.
Arkansas, I believe, was one.
Is that okay? I think what we're seeing now, frankly, is from a lack when there's a lack of federal effort, which I'll say maybe there has been to address the longer term problems. States are now figuring out they're going to have to step up and do this themselves. And figure out a way to pay for it in part, and also to pick the right projects.
Thank you.
Okay, maybe one more question. I think Representative Mahoney for Mr. Palish.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Palish, I did some rudimentary math, and $3.6 trillion. Hopefully you can help me out to make sure, check my math. As an engineer,
that's
you guys
a bad
are good
idea,
at
but keep
math.
Going.
What's the, and you actually have a lot of things in here that are not in the transportation area, energy, hazardous waste, parks and recreation, but what's the dollar per citizen in the United States or in Minnesota that this would be needed to fix this up?
Yeah, and we didn't go that far. So, I mean, I could do that math, but it's going to take me a minute because I was a journalism major in college, not an engineer. So and my math skills are limited. I could probably figure it out for you. I think what we look at, though, is the larger number, which is the delta, the difference that we're looking at. It's about $200 billion a year in the gap. That's still a lot of money. Let's make no mind about that. One of the things we look at from a transportation perspective, so to bring this a little bit more closer to home, if you look at what we would need to close that gap that we have at the federal level, which is about a 10-cent increase in the gas tax, which is the easiest way to calculate it. You can pay for it a number of different ways, but we'll calculate it through the gas tax. Your average car is about 15, 18 gallons. That's about $1.80 per tank. Maybe it's a tank per week, so it's about $1.80 per week. Maybe we round up and say it's $2.25 a week for the average car, which maybe a family has more than one car. Maybe it's $5 a week. So it's from a transportation perspective, at least at the federal level, that's sort of what you're looking at.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Mahoney,
I'm looking at your, the 2013 report card for America's infrastructure, and I just pulled out the smartphone that makes me look dumb, and put the calculator to it, and it's about $1,500 a year per person. Am I close on that? Maybe you should do the math. And but that's in my household, that's $3,000. That's a chunk of change, and I'm all for infrastructure because my folks invested heavily in the 50s, 60s, and 70s so that I had a great life and have a great life. And but I guess to make your presentation resonate more, what's the dollar figure we've got to invest per person? Because I've got, that's kind of what I have to do for my family budget.
Understood. That's a good question, and I think it's something that I'm happy to go and take a look at, and if the chair will allow, I will provide an answer for the record if you guys would like me to do that.
Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. Representative Mahoney's point is a good one. We have to think very hard about public expenditures that we make. Those are dollars out of our pockets. But I think the testifier also talked about how much we forego to our economy and how much we forego in terms of our personal ability to enjoy the fruits of our labor with additional time and fuel expense when transportation becomes a constraint on our own ability to do what we need to do in our lives and our economy's ability to do what it needs to do to create greater opportunity and prosperity for our state. So certainly dollars go into transportation, but dollars that go into transportation are an investment. We hear a lot about early childhood education, and the dollars in result in $11 out per dollar. That's an important analysis for us to have as well when we consider this transportation question.
Thank you. So we're going to take four more members' questions because we have several other, many other speakers that want to testify before. So I'm going to start with Representative Beard, then Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And this is the 12th year I've sat in this committee, and the 12th year I've heard a presentation like this. And Representative Mahoney asked the question that was burning in my mind, and I'd like to probably address it to every testifier who's going to talk this morning about the unmet need. If you could go a little more in depth just for a moment on how you define unmet need, because as a policymaker, that makes my hair stand on end. I hear it in every area of service that we have down here, that there's an unmet need, and the ability to quantify that seems to depend on which side of the check you're on, whether you're signing the front of the check or whether you're signing the back of the check. So if you could help us with that, that would be important. And you mentioned, sir, a little bit ago, you were concerned about disposable income and the amount of money that comes out of every family's pocket because of unmet needs or underinvestment in transportation in particular. And I'm glad to hear you talk about that, because that's one of the things as policymakers we wrestle with. As I look at this number on page 3 of your booklet, $3.6 trillion in investment. If we were just to say, we trust you, we're just going to pass the bill now and lay this on the taxpayers of this great country and even this state, most of us recognize that increasing taxes is a drag on the economy. at what point do we reach the balance point or the top of the bell curve here where laying on the so-called unmet need actually reduces demand and the ability of people to spend those dollars that we're supposedly saving them? And that goes for every testifier that's up here, or that's going to come up here. Don't just give us a big number, because we understand that most of you are signing the back of the check. We represent the people who sign the front of the check, and that's an important thing to us. We want them to have that extra discretionary income, but help us understand where the balance point is, where we have a world-class system, again, whatever that means. And I was on the TFAC committee. I remember the raging discussion on trying to define what is a good system, what is a balanced system, and what does world-class mean? I'm just asking, so you know the kind of things we wrestle with here. But I'm glad to see you're concerned about it, because we wrestle with other things here, and I'm thinking particularly about the Energy Committee I serve on. Right now we've got a ballooning energy cost, largely because of policies we put into play here. I sat and listened to one of the groups who signed the back of the check brag that because of policies we put in play here over the last 10 years, we've incentivized an additional $10 billion of investment just in the state of Minnesota. I think that number is high. I think it's more like $6 billion. But regardless, we've basically mandated duplicating an infrastructure. Are we doing that with this too? Are there other ways these needs can be met? And I'll tell you why I ask that. We got just one more comment, Mr. Chair. 3 years ago, we had a massive flood in Duluth. And I'm a railroad guy. I notice your railroads get a C+, and that of all the funding shortfalls you allege in here, the railroads are the shortest because they are largely private property. So the week after the flood, I'm in Duluth with the Senate chair, and we're flying in the patrol helicopter looking at the damage that we have to pay for. And it was massive, and we needed to invest as a state to help St. Louis County and Carlton County and Duluth recover from that. But I asked about my other favorite subject. How are the railroads doing? Because there's like four class ones that roll into Duluth, and they had the same damage. He said, you wouldn't have believed it, Representative. He said, and I was going to take you and show you their damage, but their damage is already all repaired. 7 days after the event, the railroads had already put their infrastructure back in place. We were just getting started. Now, I understand there's differences there. But I want you to understand that different people invest differently for different reasons, and these people have to show a tangible benefit to stockholders and customers, and this is very important. As we go forward, all the testifiers, if you'd hold that thought, help us as policymakers understand why we should put a $2.6 trillion stripe on the taxpayers, and what are we getting for it, and when are we getting it, and is that going to finally give you the world-class system you're trying to define? And will that finally fill the unmet need that I've been hearing about for 12 years around here? Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Beard. So it sounds like there's a couple of questions there. The definition of world class and what is unmet need, I think, were the two priority questions you had.
And I would say from our perspective, what we use to define the unmet need is, frankly, a series of reports published. Generally speaking, it's by the federal government, but that's generally a roll-up of state reports that are published. So, those numbers are what those numbers are. I mean, I will admit to you that we do not go through and dissect them. The transportation numbers, I think, are probably the most discussed numbers. They're some of the larger numbers, as you can see in that report. There have been a series since the Safety Lou bill, so that's about 7 or 8 years ago now, series of commissions, two of which were created by the federal government as part of that law, and they were balanced. They were both part of the Bush administration. Those commissions released their reports, where they basically came to the same conclusion in terms of the needs and in terms of what some of the policy solutions might be. And from my perspective, I guess that the definition, this is my perspective, the definition of world class would mean an infrastructure system that serves the needs of the population. And that means the population not only of you and I that live there and want to get to work in a logical fashion and not taking too terribly much time, but also that would serve the needs of businesses so that they can get their goods to market. Whether it's getting stuff from China all the way here to Minneapolis, we do a little bit of that, or whether it's getting our products out to the rest of the world, and we want to do that better so that we can create more income. I guess one of the dilemmas that we face, and to address one of your maybe not exactly stated questions, is how much is enough? I guess, you know, I struggle at the federal level when we talk about these things, and that's my perspective. So I understand that, and it has its own oddity and its perspective. I understand that as well. You know, we in Washington, D.C. haven't raised the federal gas tax since 1993. And the way I look at that, and it's not that the cost of construction has not gone up. It's not that the cost of materials, the cost of what we do hasn't gone up. I think we sometimes have done a better job spending those resources, but we still haven't done anything to change how much money's coming into the coffers since 1993. Sometimes the way I look at that is the equivalent of all of us not getting a raise from since 1993, and how would we address the same economy that we're dealing with with 1993 dollars. Now, admittedly, that's a little bit of a loose statement, shall we say, or a quick to judge statement. But I do think that we are clearly not investing enough, and we can go into other categories of the report card. But I'll leave it at that. I do think, you know, that there is a way to address a lot of the problems. It not only if we spend a little bit more money, but if we make some better choices as well.
Okay, so I just have an announcement, and just to be clear, we have three more committee members for Mr. Palsh, and then we're going to move on to Mr. Turner, and that is Representative Hausman, Senator Carlson, and Senator Osmek. But before we get to Representative Hausman, I just wanted to say that there is, I know people are standing, I love the fact that we have standing room only for a transportation hearing, but there is overflow seating in the basement hearing room if people want to watch on the closed circuit. I think that's better live, but, you know.
Mr. Chair, you can cut up in basement hearing room. You can eat popcorn. You can hoot and holler.
Okay. So. So I just wanted to make that announcement. If anyone's uncomfortable, we do have that option. So, Representative Hausman.
I think it would be important to say that when we do this math, nobody is assuming that we're going to turn this issue around overnight. That in 1 year we're going to solve the disinvestment that's been going on for some time. I think no one tells the story quite as well as this testifier. I've heard it over the years, I don't know how many times, but it tells a very clear story, and it talks about the economic damage of not doing this, but I think no one presumes that's going to happen in a year. So doing the math, I think, in that way probably isn't helpful. But I just wanted to go back to Representative Earhart's point, which you made very subtly, but which I want to revisit. I think at the national level, as you have brought forward this story, I think there has been support of the National Chamber of Commerce on this message. And you do tell the story of the damage to the economy of not investing in infrastructure in a way that would suggest normally that would catch the attention of the business community on the state level as well. And I wonder if you can comment just briefly on what your sense of support of the broader business.
And this is all public. I mean, we've worked a great deal with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, with the National Association of Manufacturers, with the AAA, not a business group, but a user group. I would say speaking solely of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, we work with them in a large national coalition with a number of groups. Some of our union friends, and I've seen them in the room today, are in that coalition, and some of the other large business groups. And so the U.S. Chamber has been supportive of this notion of investing in infrastructure. And so I can't speak for the local groups. I can speak, I'm not speaking on behalf of the Chamber, but I can tell you that we've worked a great deal with them and continue to work with them.
Thank you. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Palsh? Palsh, is that correct pronunciation? We talk a lot about the grades and the world class, and I'm wondering, do you have the perspective of the world class, of the world, for instance, our global economic competitors? I came from a corporate environment and traveled the world and saw a lot of the infrastructure in other countries. And of course, now we hear about what's going on in China. They're primarily investing the dollars we send over there into infrastructure. Their roads, and bridges, they're building new ones so fast they can't keep up with their mapping. And I'm wondering, what is the comparison of the American infrastructure with our global competitors? we know that we are responsible for encouraging that kind of infrastructure, and we also know that you will not get anything back unless you invest in it. So in the world perspective, when you look at China, Brazil, Germany, how are they in comparison with where we are?
I think a couple of the dilemmas that we face as a country, as a nation, is that you know, we started this a long time ago, right? We started investing in our infrastructure really post-World War II. We did some of it before that, but the large push was in the 50s and 60s. Our parents were the ones that really were the generation that helped us do that. And so what we're actually faced with now is rebuilding our infrastructure. You know, we have a wonderful wastewater and drinking water system, but it's old. You know, we got wooden sewers in Georgetown and Washington, D.C., which we should cheer that because some engineer was smart enough to do that. But then again, you think to yourself, wow, we have a 150-year-old wooden sewer. I mean, I don't know which way to, you know, you think about that in both ways. There have been some reports that have put out. They're not in front of me, so I don't want to get the numbers wrong. The World Economic Forum has done some reporting on where the U.S. ranks in infrastructure, and we continue to slip in infrastructure. And I want to say that we are in the teens or maybe in the low 20s. I don't want to put a number on it because I know I will get it wrong because it's not in front of me. But we continue as a nation to slip. And it's mainly because we're not looking forward and making those longer term investments. I read something last week about the opening of the new Panama Canal and how there's a great concern that this port in the Bahamas, somewhere in the Caribbean, will actually be the port of interest for everybody because our U.S. ports are not keeping up with doing the work they need to do to accept those larger ships. So it's that sort of activity that we're missing out on.
Thank you. Before I call on Senator Osmak for the last question in this section, I did see a couple of colleagues. I saw Representative Yaruso and Representative Swatsky. You're welcome to sit and ask questions and participate in the hearing if you'd like. Certainly up to you. I wanted to acknowledge you and invite you to the committee. And I know that Representative Swatsky is on the Transportation Policy Committee as well. So you're welcome. And Senator Osmak, and then we'll move on to Mr. Turner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to put this report in context, this is the report, the scorecard you're giving here. This is the in a perfect world scenario. If we had the money, if we could do things, if we had money that grew on trees and special unicorns that gave us special money, you know, this is a report that gives us an impact as far as if we could do it, this is what the grades are. It's not necessarily what's good enough, but more accurately, in a perfect scenario, this is what could be done. Is that a fair assessment?
I think what I would say is, in terms of the needs, what we're looking at is if you spend those resources that we're talking about, our goal is a B. We're not looking for the gold-plated solution. We're looking for a solid B, much like my grade point average in school, solid B. I guess I would say, I think that one of the solutions that we talked about, those three solutions, and I did skip through them quickly because I wanted to get to the questions, which has been very worthwhile. One of the dilemmas that we face is picking the right projects and making the right investments. So I think that going through a robust process to spend the dollars that we have at all levels of government wisely is an important part of the solution that we're facing. And while we may not attain the level of investment that we think we should, if we spend the money more wisely, as we add money to the system, which definitely needs to be added, I mean, I'm the first one to say that, we are well under investing in the current system, and we're continuing to see significant problems, but we need to make good choices.
Mr. Chair, one follow-up.
Senator Osmak.
Earlier you responded to one of my House colleagues with comments about how much a per week cost of an average homeowner might be for certain, you know, to try and solve the situation. You threw out numbers such as $1.80, $5 a tank, whatever the case might be. But you'll also concede then, too, that by raising gas taxes and raising the cost of industry, you're going to be indirectly, while you would directly hit consumers in the wallet with a certain portion per week, you will indirectly be impacting those consumers with higher costs of goods and services as a result of a gas tax. You'd have to concede that, correct?
I guess what I would concede is that we're already paying some of those monies now. I mean, if I'm in Washington, D.C., wasting 60 hours a year in the car trying to get home, which I am, I don't know if it's quite that much, but that's the average in Washington, D.C. I can play out the math on that and say that I'm already wasting whatever that amount of time versus the gasoline that I'm wasting in my car. And so I think there's a leveling that may occur if we invest enough in our infrastructure that I'm going to waste less time. I think large companies who have logistics issues, their way of addressing this, some of them is they just increase the price of their products if they're stuck in traffic. So, I mean, I think there's a lot of give and take in this, which is why we did the economic study to try and get an understanding of what underinvesting was doing to all of us, and what that really meant for the economy.
Thank you very much, Mr. Palish, and thank you for making the trip from Washington.
Thank you very much.
And I know that you'll be around for a little while if people have some additional comments and questions. I'd like to now call up Darrell Turner. He's the Minnesota Division Administrator for the USDOT. And members, what I'd like to transition to in terms of this part of the hearing is that interplay between state and federal funding. I know many people around this table have a particular project in their community that they're interested in the status of, you know, be it Highway 14, be it I-94, be it 169 up on the range. So there's an interplay between federal and state funding for all of these projects, and I know Mr. Palish talked about the challenges we have at the federal government, and we're going to have Commissioner Zelli on next to talk about the state. But give us a sense, Mr. Turner, again, the status of the Highway Trust Fund. What are its impacts in terms of these Minnesota projects and anything else you'd like to discuss with us? Welcome to the committee. I'm so glad you could make it, Mr. Turner.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. It's indeed a pleasure to be here. The members of this committee, thank you for inviting me to appear before you today to provide an overview of the Highway Trust Fund. The Highway Trust Fund is an account that Congress established to hold federal highway excise taxes that are dedicated for highway and transit-related purposes. The Highway Trust Fund has two accounts, the highway account and the mass transit account. Receipts from the Highway Trust Fund come from a variety of taxes on highway fuel, tires, heavy vehicle use, trucks, and trailers. The motor fuel excise tax, which we are all familiar with, is currently 18.4 cents per gallon for gasoline and gasohol, and 24.4 cents for diesel, kerosene, and these two raise the majority of our revenue. After the Internal Revenue Service collects this revenue, the U.S. Department of Treasury then deposits it into the Highway Trust Fund, and the U.S. Department of Transportation uses these deposits to make payments to states and other entities as costs are incurred and billed to the federal government. Now, just to give you some history on the Highway Trust Fund, Congress established the Highway Trust Fund in 1956 to provide a financially sound, reliable, and consistent approach for funding highway infrastructure. Over time, Congress has expanded the Highway Trust Fund to fund transit and highway safety programs. This funding construct ensured a dedicated funding source for these purposes. The Highway Trust Fund is based on the user pays principle, by which highway users pay cents per gallon fuel tax on gasoline and diesel, in addition to several other excise taxes, with revenue dedicated to the Highway Trust Fund. The use of contract authority, which Congress first legislated for the highway program in the Post Office Appropriations of 1923, allowed Congress to make major decisions about the federal aid highway program in multi-year authorization bills rather than through annual appropriations process. This process provided assurances to the states and other grant recipients that federal resources needed to fund major projects would be available over a longer period of time, giving state legislatures and transportation planners confidence to move forward with project development. Since 1974, contract authority has been an option only for programs funded by trust funds. In 1956, the gasoline tax was 3 cents per gallon. And in 1959, Congress raised it to 4 cents per gallon. In 1983, President Ronald Reagan signed the Surface Transportation Assistance Act of 1982, which raised the gas tax to 9 cents per gallon and expanded the use of the Highway Trust Fund to include a new account to support public transportation. The same act also divided the Highway Trust Fund into two accounts, the Highway account and the Mass Transit account. In 1990, President George H.W. Bush signed the Omnibus Budget Reconciliation of Acting of 1990, which raised the gas tax by 5 cents, bringing it to 14.1 cents per gallon. But half of that increase was dedicated to the general fund for federal deficit reduction. In 1993, President Bill Clinton passed a similar bill, increasing the gas tax by 4.3 cents. Bringing the total to 18.4 cents, with the entire increase going into the general fund for deficit reduction. Eventually, Congress redirected to the Highway Trust Fund the portions of the gas tax originally reserved for deficit reduction. In the Omnibus Bill of 1993, redirected the Highway Trust Fund the initial 2.5 cents for deficit reduction beginning in October 1995. The Taxpayer Relief Act of 1997 redirected to the Highway Trust Fund the remaining 4.3 cents for deficit reduction. For the first four decades of its existence, the Highway Trust Fund collected interest on unspent balances. The Transportation Equity Act for the 21st Century, often called T21, eliminated that authority effective October 1, 1998. Congress later restored the Highway Trust Fund's ability to earn interest in the Surface Transportation Extension Act of 2010. Although purchasing power has decreased and highway construction costs have increased by more than 70% over the last two decades, the federal gas tax has remained at 18.4 cents per gallon since 1993. Of this tax, 15.44 cents goes to the highway account and 2.86 cents goes to the mass transit account. The remaining 0.1 cents goes to the Leaking Underground Storage Tank Trust Fund, which the Environmental Protection Agency administers. So where are we today? As has been noted recently, there are concerns that the balance in the Highway Trust Fund may experience a shortfall before the end of the federal fiscal year, which is September 30th. Secretary of Transportation Anthony Fox recently announced that the Department of Transportation has posted the Highway Trust Fund balance on its website, and that the department plans to update that number every month until the Highway Trust Fund can sustain itself. If the balances were to drop low enough, the department might be forced to slow reimbursement payments to states and make only partial payments as well. Finding sustainable funding for the Federal Surface Transportation Program is an urgent challenge for confronting policymakers. Since its inception, the Highway Trust Fund has provided a means for funding surface transportation investments. Yet in recent years, investment needs and authorized funding levels have outpaced the available highway user revenues. And as a result, the Highway Trust Fund has come perilously close to being insolvent. From fiscal years 2008 through 2014, Congress transferred $55 billion to the Highway Trust Fund, including almost $19 billion in the Moving Ahead for Progress in the 21st Century, which we call MAP 21. The administration is pledged to work with Congress and transportation stakeholders throughout the country to find a bipartisan solution to this urgent challenge. In his State of the Union address, the President called on Congress to pass a much-needed transportation bill this summer and reiterated his proposal to fund transportation with the proceeds from corporate tax reform. The department is committed to working with Congress to achieve a long-term authorization quickly. The department continues to monitor the situation closely, and we will work to keep our state partners informed. I have provided you two graphs, one focusing on the highway account balances for federal fiscal years 2010 through 2014. That's this graph over here. And the other focusing on federal fiscal year 2014 projected estimates for end-of-month cash balances. That's this graph here. Both of these graphs are on FHWA's website and are updated on a monthly basis. Thank you again for allowing me this opportunity to speak before you, and I'd be happy to take questions if you have any.
Thank you, Mr. Turner. And before we start on the questions, I just want to point out this graph that's to our right, but, I mean, this is beginning in April. I mean, you can't have a fiscal cliff more clearly depicted than in this graph. If you look at what's happening from April of this year down towards August of this year, that's a cliff we're about to go over. And members, I did also want to call to your attention the bipartisan letter from 17 governors that we distributed earlier. It's on the letterhead of the National Transportation Coalition. And so this is interesting because you have Scott Walker from Wisconsin and Governor Dayton on the same letter. So, you know, we've got a pretty wide variety of viewpoints. But I'll just read one sentence, which I think we should all take to heart. And it deals with this very issue that Mr. Turner talked about. This is in the third paragraph. If remedial action is not taken in a timely manner, the consequences would harm the economy of every state. Again, this is a letter that both Governor Walker and Governor Dayton signed. So I'd be happy now. We'll take a couple questions for Mr. Turner, and then Mr. Zelli is on deck. I thought I saw Representative Beard.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Turner, thank you. It's good to see you again this morning. On the chart over there, just for the committee's edification, in March of 2010, it looks like the balance on account jumped about $17 billion when everything else has been flat or slow decline. Can you help us understand what happened there?
The jumps that you see are where I mentioned that there were infusions from the general fund.
Okay.
In each of those cases where you see that jump, that's where we received those infusions of cash from the general fund.
Thank you.
So those are actually general fund monies.
Thank you, Representative Beard. Other questions of the committee for Mr. Turner? Yes.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative
Chair.
Benson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr.
Good
Chair.
Good to see you again.
Thank you. Mr. Turner, so is there any reason to believe that before we get to the end of the fiscal year that will end in September, that there won't be a similar infusion of money from the general fund to make it solvent again?
Mr. Turner.
That would be a question that only the policymakers in D.C. could answer. You know, our department is willing to work with Congress to keep the trust fund solvent, but ultimately that's a decision that they'll have to work out amongst the two of them.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Benson.
Thank you. Mr. Turner, so there's been no discussions at all between in the transportation committees at a federal level and the policymakers regarding what appears to be at least an insolvent fiscal cliff, as you describe it. You know, in terms of taking general fund money, we just did see a bipartisan bill signed into law to, you know, have a federal budget. Where there are no discussions at all. If you can answer that question regarding whether or not we'll see money go into that account,
Representative, I'm sure there are questions, but at my level, I wouldn't be involved in those. I think everyone is aware of the situation that we face, and they all view it urgently. But beyond that, I really don't have any other information as to how those discussions are playing out.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks. Thank you, Mr. Turner, for the information. It would be not wise or appropriate for Mr. Turner to speculate on what Congress will do. I can say from what I've been able to learn from reading updates from the National Conference of State Legislatures and other groups that follow these things. There are those conversations occurring, and I'd encourage members to go out to the NCSL website, Transportation Committee. There's a lot of good information about kind of on a real-time basis of kind of what's going on in Congress. The short version is, you know, Congress is completely dysfunctional, so I can speculate. I don't think anything's going to happen. I think we're going to go over this cliff, very likely.
Follow-up.
Benson.
That was the reason behind the line of questions is that indeed, you know, we're painting the picture of the sky is falling, but in fact, I believe the policymakers in Washington are very aware of the condition that the fund is in, and they will make provisions to make sure that it doesn't go insolvent. So, you know, before we think the sky is falling, and unless we believe that they're totally dysfunctional, they did just hammer out a bipartisan bill for a budget.
Okay. Well, I think we'll hear also that thank you for that, Representative Benson, but I think even solvency is probably not the is. I think there's also some potential impacts, even if it's solvent, and I know that I've heard that from MnDOT and others. So we'll get into that. So there's two issues. There's is this level, and then this very well depicted cliff. Senator Dibble, and then just, Senator Thomasson.
Just responding quickly to Representative Benson. I'm happy to hear of your optimism. I would love to share in it. And perhaps the recent bipartisan agreement is a sign of things to come. But recall, there was a government shutdown that preceded this outbreak of bipartisanship, and that may well be what happens in the transportation arena as well, to finally kickstart folks to confront the reality of what's going on. But I'm willing to borrow a little bit of your optimism.
We are at the whims of Washington D.C. here. I'm going to have two. We have two more questions from the committee. Senator Thomasoni, and then Representative Earhart, and we'll move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, would you explain this graph, please? I'm just trying to figure out why we have this level.
Okay.
Amount, and then
the green.
I'm assuming it's because this is when construction starts. Is that why, or?
These are actually cash payments out to state DOTs and other entities out of the highway account of the federal trust fund. The green line is the actual disbursements that we've made to date. The blue line is what we project out based on past history and projects that we've authorized. Barring no other infusions of cash, the blue line is what we project would happen by the end of the federal fiscal year, which is September 30th of this year.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Thomasson.
Mr. Chairman, barring no infusions of cash that are up and above the gas tax, is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Okay.
Thank you. And then Representative Earhart for the last question for Mr. Turner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I understand correctly from your figures here, there are no drainage from the federal fund for transportation except the 0.1 cent. No, nothing going now for debt reduction.
That's correct, Representative Earhart.
Thank you.
Any other questions, members? Thank you, Mr. Turner. We really appreciate your work here on behalf of the federal government here in Minnesota, and thank you for your ongoing partnership with us.
Thank you.
And now we're going to transition to some of the issues at the state level, not only the interplay between the what we've learned about federal fiscal challenges, but also what's happened in the state since we last gathered here almost a year ago, and some of your perspectives on this issue, Commissioner Zelli. And thank you so much for being here and waiting patiently as we move from the federal to state issues. And then following Mr. Zelli, Commissioner Zelli, we'll have some testimony from the public, and then we'll wrap up our hearing after that. So welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Chairman Hornstein, and Chairman Dibble, and members of both committees. It is indeed an honor to be here. It is about a year ago, and it was only one day on the job, and I have to tell you I have learned a lot in the past year and have traveled the state, not only talking about a vision for the next 20 years, but also, more importantly, listening to individual groups, citizens, business groups, elected officials, and I have a much greater appreciation of the challenges and the opportunities facing the state. One thing that, and this gets maybe even to Representative Beard's idea, and I'll get back to in a minute, of building a world-class system, we actually changed the vision statement for the MnDOT as an agency about 6 months ago. And we took out the word world-class, because, quite honestly, I'm not quite sure what that means. But the new vision is about maintaining a multimodal transportation system that maximizes the health of people, the environment, and the economy. And it is not lost on me, after listening to stories, not only listening, but actually taking tours through manufacturing facilities, businesses throughout the state, greater Minnesota and in the metro, that our economy is deeply dependent upon the quality and the efficiency of our transportation system. So really, our vision is really to be a supporting tool to what Minnesotans most care about. And hopefully we can measure not just the health of people, but the health of communities and obviously the the economy is about not just employers, but employees' access to jobs. Amazing that we have this robust economy, being the fifth among nation's fastest-growing economies and certainly a great place to doing business. But in talking to manufacturers and businesses, large and small, the resounding comment I get, and I don't think it's just because I'm the transportation commissioner, but they say their number one issue is logistics. It's about getting raw goods and to the facility and to export, whether it's truck, rail, car, or even services, to not be locked, not just by congestion, but by the quality of the system itself. So it is not just what is happening today. The issues that are facing our system is in fact quite serious when you consider the population coming into the state of Minnesota. It's a different kind of population, obviously, to attract talent, but also to attract a workforce. Means we have to have a kind of a number of different options, not just highways, to attract people. Truck freight is increasing substantially, and our projections at MnDOT have a 30% increase over the next 15 years. But you know what? I think given what I've been learning about the amount of not just truck but rail freight coming from North Dakota through our state, I think 30% might be a bit modest. Vehicle miles may actually be flat, but truck and the ability to support our commerce is an increasingly important consideration. Other states are investing in transportation. This is just a quick map to show you what happened this last year. There was a number of initiatives at state legislatures where they have raised new revenue to support infrastructure. You'll notice we're one of the pink states. It was under consideration. Actually, I guess you might say that's a darker shade of pink because we did have the corridors of commerce, which was bonding capacity of $300 million, which our intention as an agency is to put those dollars to work the minute they become available, which would be July 1st, and we've announced 10 projects. You can see that whereas we were kind of in the middle of the pack or maybe slightly higher end of the pack in terms of our gas tax and fees, we are now going down because other states, as we've heard both from earlier testimony, are facing similar issues as the state of Minnesota is. So here are the challenges. I think this is some issues that you've all heard about, and we can put some pretty solid arithmetic behind it, but it's true, even though we've gotten a C-plus on bridges, that's only because we've done some pretty significant investment over the past few years. Nonetheless, 50% of our pavements are over 50 years old. We rate actually very poorly in terms of pavement quality compared to other states. And if today is any measure, we are we're in a very challenging environment. And our pavements, our roads, our bridges, and all other modes, frankly, are significantly challenged by our climate. So we talk about the funding needs, and it's true. I was part of the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee with some of you, but looks carefully at what the need is over the next 20 years. I would just kind of point out that this is just the capital investment need. It doesn't really address the operating costs of all modes, but it at least is a pretty good benchmark of solid arithmetic behind what it would take to maintain our system, both currently as it is, and to expand it. And I'll go back to that idea of world class. I'm calling it, and we're thinking about it, as economically competitive. I really am defining this as to say, what would we have to be in order to stay consistent with the Utahs or the Virginias or the Missouris, those states that we not only compete with for talent, but that we compete with to maintain our our prosperity. So I think there are more solid benchmarks, and hopefully and over time we're getting more performance measures to know what exactly do we mean to be economically competitive. So this is just the summary. I won't go into every little line item, but just to tell you the $12 billion gap over the next 20 years for just the state highway and bridge investments, which is really the difference between the $30 billion that we have programmed as need versus the $18 billion, which is what we're forecasting as sources of funding. Again, part of those sources of funding is the federal government, and we are assuming in this forecast that the federal government will continue to be at about the level it is now. The $600 million or so dollars that comes by formula to the state of Minnesota from the Federal Highway Department is approximately 20% of our budget. So it is not all of it, but it is a very important component. But I also point out that just the county system and the municipal system alone, that's really an additional over $10 billion over the next 20 years. So, and all of this is capital funds. It does not include the cost of operation, the cost of maintenance, the ongoing snow and ice to guardrail repairs, which are really important when we think about maintaining a competitive system. We have a vision. This is not the vision of the existing funds. This is the vision of what if there was $12 billion for investment on state roads and bridges, what would it look like? It would really, the point of this slide and this map is to show that it is really comprehensive. It is the entire state. It is both Greater Minnesota and Metro. The reason this Metro multimodal vision is also shown is to show that when Chair Haig from the Metropolitan Council talks about transit investments, she's really showing the same map. There is both MnDOT highway funding as well as transit funding, both required to build out an integrated system. And although I'm talking a lot about highways and bridges, which is where the bulk of MnDOT funding goes, it's not lost that our multimodal vision includes greater Minnesota transit, rail funding, bike and ped amenities, which I think are more than amenities as I gather around the state, that kind of a core to some of the economic development of many communities. But this picture shows that the transit system, which is highlighted with these multicolored lines in the metro, actually involve highway lanes that would be improved, interchanges that would be funded through MnDOT funds, as well as BRT, which would go also on some highway investment. So getting really to the point, and I think that's important to think about the sources. Although we talk about the great need and maybe some performance measures to quantify that need, there is a risk associated with the various sources of funding we currently have. The biggest one that's well known, but we can't say it enough, is that our fuel tax is set based upon how much vehicles consume of gas. So as vehicle miles are relatively flat, cars are becoming more fuel efficient, and although that tax is not indexed to any kind of increase in our costs, it would actually purchasing power go down. So although we have multiple sources of revenue that goes to the highway debt, it would actually purchasing power go down. So although we have multiple sources of revenue that goes to the highway dedicated funds, the gas tax is becoming a smaller and smaller amount of that funding and causing us the greatest challenge. Had gas tax been indexed 20 years ago, we would not be having this presentation because keeping pace with the costs of construction, the costs of programming, even the costs of some of our materials don't stay constant.
Mr.
Senator Dibble.
Sorry to interrupt your train of thought.
Not at all.
It's a great presentation. I've gotten this analysis before. It'd be interesting to get it again. I know that fuel efficiency is part of the reason, but you also mentioned that vehicle miles traveled, at least on a per capita basis, are flat,
right,
declining as well. I think that also factors into gas tax as a declining source. It'd be interesting to know the relative proportions.
Well, and I don't know how much is accountable to actual fuel efficiency. We could look at that. But it is interesting to note that as the cost of car ownership not just increases, it's really the cost of insurance, cost of parking, and of course fuel costs. There's many costs associated with owning and maintaining a single occupancy car. Mm-hmm. So whereas we've seen increase in transit, we also see increases in carpooling, bike commuting, and you name it. And it really is about garnering greater efficiency out of a single vehicle. And as we do that, we might actually have population increases. And being a reformed bus guy, I count passengers rather than just vehicle miles. We expect passenger and mobility to increase. It's just the idea of single cars to remain level and probably in different areas that may cause congestion. So I think that getting some good arithmetic about the increase in fuel efficiency would be a good one, and we'll work on that.
Okay, thank you.
We'll proceed, Commissioner.
Thank you. An important consideration about our challenge in revenue sources is without sufficient investment sources, we are not able to stay on top of what we call life cycle investments. I'll go back to my bus experience. When we purchase a $500,000 vehicle that will last approximately 1.5 million miles over 12 to 15 years, that can only be achieved by making prudent investments to refurbish and maintain that asset. Somewhere around 700,000 miles after about 8-9 years, a new transmission, a new engine, new seats, new bodywork maintains that asset, and that bus can last another 6 or 7 years. Well, it turns out roads, bridges, and pavements are exactly the same. We're able to make the smart investment when it really pays off to keep and extend that very expensive asset that much longer. We made a critical investment in the Blotnick Bridge this summer for only $17.5 million. That bridge will now last another 10 to 15 years. Had we not, we would be facing a $200 million, I don't know quite sure how much, total bridge replacement. All these assets, roads, bridges, do not last forever. But to be smart about how we make refurbishment investments is part of what I think is a critical, prudent investment strategy. Without enough resources, we're not able to stay on top of what is commonly referred to as deferred depreciation in the private sector. So we talked a lot about the ability to issue bonds to make capital investments. We have issued a significant amount of debt over the past 5 years. Much of that has been able to be funded because of the modest gas tax increase in 2008. But nonetheless, we have actually issued more bonds than even that modest gas tax increase would cover. So we have a debt policy limit at MnDOT and for the state of Minnesota, and that is that we would not issue bonds that our debt service would exceed 20% of MnDOT revenues. And as you can see from this chart, we have programmed investments that will take us right up to that limit. The last authorization was this last legislature, the Corridors of Commerce. $300 million really brings us up to that limit. So we do not have more capacity to issue bonds under the existing sources of revenue.
And members, I want to just really underscore this point. You know, Commissioner Zelli said that's it. That's it for our ability to issue bonds unless we have more revenue. And so I do feel that, you know, we have tremendous uncertainty. You know, some around the table are very optimistic about Congress. Some are very pessimistic about Congress. You know, but at best we have a real uncertain federal situation. And now Commissioner Zelli has underlined and underscored the fact that we have absolutely no trunk bonding left in the state, none. And so this really does present us with, I think, both of these, I think, are a kind of perfect storm, if you will, in terms of our ability to add new revenue into the system. So I appreciate that you brought that up, and I think that's, you know, you have several bullet points, you know, in terms of, you call it financial risk, and I believe that's very appropriate. Loss of purchasing power, that's this graph. Increased life cycle costs, and that's, you know, MnDOT has very clearly, study after study has talked about what I call a pavement crisis in 2020, we're going to have a couple thousand miles that we need to deal with, and now the debt ceiling. So this is a, you know, you look at these three things in combination, and, you know, we really are in a very serious moment here in terms of our ability to move forward in transportation.
Mr. Chairman.
So,
Mr. Chairman, to that point.
Yes, Senator Tomasoni.
Chairman and Commissioner Zelli, the 20% limit, is that self-imposed or where does that come from?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, it is a policy that was adopted several years ago by the agency, and it has been confirmed by the administration and the legislature. It is not a, in my understanding, it's not a statute. However, there are other true credit restraints and for MnDOT that goes to the overall state debt capacity. So there are other although the debt is 100% paid by trunk highway funds, it goes into the overall state indebtedness. So this 20% is what our kind of main threshold is, but if we talk to the management and budget, they will also say no, that's where it is in terms of a percentage of state revenues, so all revenue.
Commissioner Zelli, it's sort of the equivalent of maxing out on the credit card.
It is. The bank has kind of told us that's about where you should be. and we actually support that.
You could really issue another credit card if you want.
Well, Senator Dibble.
Thanks. Not to belabor this point. To go beyond the 20%, as Commissioner Zelli articulated, would probably affect our credit rating, both within the fund but at the state overall. This self-imposed policy came about in the last few years. It was in response to a proposal from previous administration, who shall remain nameless, which proposed a debt program that actually, I don't even know if we would have been able to sell those particular bonds under that particular scenario, but it would have taken the trunk highway fund in the out years into the red. We wouldn't have been able to service the debt that had been proposed in that initial. We didn't adopt that, of course, but it did highlight the need to establish, because there were no guidelines at that point, and there was no constraint even within the agency, and so it's probably a good idea to have this policy and to stick to it.
And members, because this is, I think, sort of the core of the gist of the change that's taken place since we last met at the state level. We can spend a little bit of time on this now, but there's still six more slides that Commissioner Zelli has. So what I'm going to do is call on Representative Benson and then have Commissioner Zelli make any additional comments you want to make in terms of this fiscal bonding cliff we have, and then finish your presentation, then we'll get into some more sure. Q&A with the commissioner. So Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It'll be a short question. Hopefully a short answer. But Commissioner Zelli, as I've been doing pre-session meetings with local governments, unanimously they have expressed extreme disappointment over the amount of transportation funds in the governor's bonding bill, almost unanimous. And so my question is, you know, given all we know and all we need to improve on, $79 million out of almost $1 trillion bonding bill seems of, and I understand that the bonding bill is
trillion?
Excuse me, billion. Yeah. Well, it's almost a trillion. It's almost, yeah. Okay. It's almost a billion.
He's got his head.
I've got my numbers wrapped around all these trillions.
He's got the need number out there, yeah. Commissioner Sally.
Approximately $985 million. How does it put it that way? It's $1 billion. So, you know, when we begin to look at the needs, my question to you is, did you even have a seat at the table? I know it's a political document, and we have to pull a lot of corners of the state around, but did you even have a seat at the table when that discussion was being had, $79 million? And are you disappointed in the amount that's included in the bonding bill?
Well,
Mr.
Chairman, Senator Benson, I'm very fortunate to be at the table, and we make recommendations, not all of which were chosen, but recognizing that the general obligation bonds, which is the $1 billion, and I wish it was trillion, that would be fabulous, was the issue. Those bonds are for local roads and some needs which are not associated with the state system. So we actually, by law, are precluded from using general obligation bonds for the needs that I'm describing here. And knowing the governor has recognized that the state has many investment needs, that the transportation, the bulk of the transportation funding is part of the dedicated funds for the state highway system. And by formula, 40% roughly go to counties and municipalities. So recognizing that we would all love a much larger bonding bill, but balancing the needs of the state and the requirements for transportation, there's probably much greater needs that go beyond the general obligation.
Short follow-up.
Sure, Representative.
In understanding that it was talks with local governments,
right.
Could you see moving forward at least that you could convince the governor for a greater portion of the bonding bill, whichever that number is, that would be dedicated to those roads and bridges? Because many of the things that we've talked about in terms of economics and logistics are important to those folks too.
Well, the governor is very nice, and he encourages me to not only be transparent with him, but to be very open about what we recommend. And we have our recommendation is a comprehensive and sustainable over a great period of time for the larger transportation picture, and that we certainly need to make progress every chance we can get, but the solution is a statewide more comprehensive solution than a project by project, although those projects are certainly important.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just wanted to thank Representative Benson. I think we have an issue in common here. We can get some work done.
We've broken out in bipartisanship.
Yes, we can show Congress how to do it.
Okay, well, members, if there's no further questions at this point, I'd ask Commissioner Zelli just to finish your last six slides, and then we can see if there's more Q&A for the commissioner.
Well, before I leave the slide, I would just introduce one other risk, which is really the interest rate risk. I mean, there's two ways to have higher interest rates. One is you borrow too much. The other is just rates are going up, and we've been enjoying a period of low rates. Currently, we've issued about $1 billion toward the projects that are underway for this, what we refer to as Chapter 152 funding. This graph really shows that we will probably issue another $1 billion that has been projects that are underway, that have been programmed and spoken for. But we are assuming gradual increases in rates, but that is another risk that we have to kind of understand when we look at borrowing. One of the things we've looked at this last year is exactly what some of you have asked, which is, are these investments meaningful to taxpayers and to users of the system? We actually gathered a group of about 40 stakeholders with help from business leaders to measure direct benefits versus actual costs and to see if there was a return on investment. This is one of the principles behind the Transportation Finance Advisory Committee, and led and lectured in part by Federal Reserve economist Art Rolnick, who said positive returns can be meaningful. That means that the stakeholders, the users of a system, can benefit. So we looked at direct benefits, ones that could be measured, using kind of a variety of different tools. With an outside resource, not within MnDOT, an outside group to make those measures. And And the quick summary is that they, over this period of time, for that $12 billion, there is about a 2.5 times the benefits. In other words, a $31 billion benefit if you take all the factors versus the $12 billion investment. So we feel like it does have a good investment, and not counting all the intangible economic data, these are actually measurable traffic data and life cycle investment benefits and the like. One of the questions I get a lot traveling around the state and is when we raised the gas tax and we issued these bonds, what happened? And I think one of the reasons we have a slightly higher grade and bridge integrity versus other states is that we have made significant investments in both refurbishing, but then also in many cases replacing, or in the case of St. Croix Crossing, a brand new bridge, and some pretty significant projects. And if you can kind of see through the list, it isn't just the large St. Croix Crossing, which is really shown here at 280 to 310 million, but that's just the Minnesota portion. That's about a 600 or so or more million dollar project. But they are statewide, and we think that pretty significant improvement. Likewise, it wasn't just bridges. We did a lot of pavement improvement with the Chapter 152 bonds, as shown. Gets back into that debt slide. These kind of projects are now over because they've been programmed, and we're either in the process of completing them, or they've been completed. One of the projects I just focus on as an example with the pictures is the Hastings Bridge, as ways to make smart investments that have a high return. This was a bridge that would not have been funded had it not been for the 2008 funding and the Chapter 152 programming. This is not only a state-of-the-art bridge; it is the longest arch span in the Western Hemisphere, so I'm told by my engineers. I'm not one, but it had used innovative practices, and probably the most significant in terms of innovation is the fact that we actually had the old bridge open the entire time. It was built on the side of the river, and it's more than a cool video. It actually saved diverting traffic 47 miles for a two-year period, and it would have been an extreme economic cost. So I think this gets to the question earlier, is like, well, where do these cost savings sometimes come from? Is there a cost to raising a gas tax for shippers? I will tell you 100% of the time, the shippers I talk to, they want a direct route for their trucks, and a 47-mile detour on a major state Highway 61 project would have been devastating, and maybe would have been a number of business failures had that happened. Likewise, that bridge, had we not had the funding to do the project, would at the very least have been reduced in terms of its weight that it would allow, and maybe even closed. So this is a great example of not only a prudent funding strategy, but also an innovative construction technique that saved the taxpayers' funding. We also, min pass lanes are actually all about driving density through existing assets. When we make these expansions, and we are working on one in 35E, we'll expect to not only reduce congestion, but drive more people through existing roadways. That is about using performance-based metrics to take the existing resources we have and use them prudently. Two more quick slides. We have a strategic priority at MnDOT. A year ago, we had 120. I won't say that we're dropping a lot of the initiatives associated with those various strategies, flagships, goals, but we will continue to stress innovation. We are not dropping safety. We're not dropping some of the priorities that we do every day. But we do have one overriding goal, and that is to enhance our financial effectiveness. We are operating a business. It is a multi-billion dollar project execution and services business. So we should be able to measure and be able to understand the costs of all of our products and services, be able to think about how we scope and manage projects, and how we can actually be more state-of-the-art in terms of our asset management program. And that is simply, when I say we're running this like a business, we do have a bottom line, and the bottom line is what the taxpayers receive for the funding that that we get. And so hopefully, and we will expect, actually we are receiving help from business associations, chambers, and outside consultants, as well as our own expertise to bring this further. When we talk about the sources that are needed, we are put 15% of all new sources will come from our own efficiencies, we are just putting a stake in the ground that we have to start in-house, but some of that efficiency will come from deploying our capital wisely. So it is not a show us the efficiencies and then have the funding. They do go hand in hand. We've talked about where would those additional funding come from. Curiously enough, the gas tax only is really less than half of the other sources that come from the state in terms of motor vehicle sales tax and the registration fees. We know that some way indexing, having either a gas tax or the conversations we've had about sales tax on the non-tax portion of fuel has a dynamic that where it can go up or down with many of the costs of our program, like asphalt, fuels that go up and down. We somehow have a diversified portfolio of revenue, I think is something that we're recommending to the governor or anybody who listens to us, that we like to have a diversified, something that is indexed over time with the cost of our program. And you can see there's a number of different sources. Some of them, we have transportation-related fees that go to the general fund. Maybe they should be dedicated to transportation. We think the dedicated user fee kind of idea is a good one, and that we think one that addresses, again, the inflation risk is important. We talk about next-generation revenue sources. Minnesota is part of a coalition of states that are looking at user fee mileage-based programs. We don't think that is ready for us, but we know that that innovation is probably going to come from states, not the federal government. No aspersions to federal highway, but we're working with other states. Oregon has actually got a good demonstration program. We're on a voluntary basis. People are paying based on how many miles they drive, and we just ought to stay in touch with them and think about that really for something maybe 10 years from now, but we got to start the work now in the conversation now. That is my presentation. Thank you. Happy to take questions.
We'll take a couple questions, and then we have a lot of folks from the public that want to speak as well. I know Representative Beard has been waiting patiently, and then we'll go to Representative Mahoney from there.
Mr. Chairman, this isn't a question as much as just further enlightenment for the committee's consideration. On page 4, Commissioner Zelli talked about the 20% number for our indebtedness, our bonding number for fiscal prudence, and that's a pretty wise number. The comment was made by one of my colleagues that, you know, the previous administration had come up with an idea for borrowing that perhaps wasn't completely baked, maybe needed some more time in the oven. But the point is, there were some things, you should know there were some things going on with construction inflation and interest rates that made it prudent to consider bonding at that time. And up till that point, this body and the agency had always been on a pay-as-you-go kind of basis. That was just kind of the way we were brought up, I guess. But that there were some things that came into play that said, wait a minute, maybe we should reconsider how we do some of these, especially the big projects, not the ongoing maintenance, but the new stuff we needed to do, like the Hastings Bridge or the Lafayette Bridge replacement and so on. Because in the real world, where the people who sit out here work, the contractors and so on, when they have to borrow money against a good that is inflating faster than the interest rate, well, that's pretty much a no-brainer. You take that deal, because the dollars you pay it back with are worth less than the asset you end up with at the end of the day. So I want to applaud the agency in particular for helping us see our way through that and helping craft what I think to be a responsible fiscal policy. If we hold it to 20% of trunk highway funds, at this time, at this juncture, whenever construction costs have come in, it's so darn good, we've been able to maximize the dollars we've been able to borrow The interest rate we're paying is much less than still the alleged interest rate on construction materials. But the word of caution I must share is at some point those lines are going to cross. When interest rates go back up and exceed inflation, this is a whole new day, and we're probably going to see that tool in our toolbox probably become useless and obsolete. So just some observations. Thank you, Mr.
Very good point, Representative Beard. So here's the situation with our questions and our future testimony. I'm going to take four more. Representative Mahoney, Representative Bernardi, Senator Jensen, and Representative Earhart. And then I'd like to make sure that Mayor Tabke gets ready and Cynthia Pick, and then those will be our first two public testifiers. So just giving us a roadmap of where we're headed. So quick questions. Representative Mahoney, you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Zelli, I chair the Jobs and Economic Development Committee. I talk to businesses across the state. There's a couple of trend lines that keep moving businesses from the urban area out to our greater Minnesota area. And once you move these businesses out to greater Minnesota, you need to have the transportation system that logistics you talked about earlier. So my question is, have any, not just the Minnesota State Chamber, but any of the chambers in the state come out in favor of any of the options that your last slide talked about, the additional funding considerations, and have any of the Chamber of Commerce's come out against any of these? It's a broad-based question. Who likes you? Who doesn't like you?
Well, you know, Commissioner Zelli's the bus guy, so he knows a little about this topic. Commissioner Zelli?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, you know, I can't speak officially for the chambers, but I will say, traveling around the state, I've had a great deal of interest from local chambers, and whether that's Marshall or Wilmer or you name it, they're very close to their communities and recognize the need for some of the projects that will have a positive return. So I think that I've had very good reception from local chambers. I know in the certainly in the Minneapolis and St. Paul metro chambers have been very supportive. Have had a number of interests, knowing that transportation is one of their highest priorities. And I'm not sure where they are in terms of advocating for a particular solution, but I think they've recognized that revenue, additional revenue, is required. So they've been very supportive. I know the state chamber has taken a big interest in a more renewed interest in transportation. They have taken the position now that they would like to see or have confidence in the efficiencies, and so I am continuing to meet with them before they would advocate for additional revenue. But I see that as at least the door is open, and that they have expressed an interest to continue to meet, and that they said they wouldn't oppose it necessarily forever, but they need a little more confidence about where the money would go. So that's real time where we are today, but they haven't, they've been interested at least in being engaged in the issue.
Very quick follow-up, Representative Mahoney, and then we'll move on to Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Commissioner Zelli, you're awfully kind, because they were in my office, and I came away with the impression that they weren't going to support any kind of transportation increase in any near future. So I find that interesting. All the other chambers think it's not a bad idea, but our big state one, very, very hesitant to be kind to them.
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative, having served on that board, I know that they probably take what I think are stances, but I know the individual businesses, and I meet with those individual people and their individual businesses, and they say the logistics and the infrastructure are critical to their business, and they're not shy about telling me how important it is. So I would let this play out, because I think good sense and irrational reasons and arithmetic usually wins out at the end.
Thank you. Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Zelli, for being here today. I appreciate your leadership and your work on creating a vision for a multimodal transportation system in Minnesota. One of the things you talk about is maximizing the health, environment, and the economy. And one way we're talking today about the need for funding. I like that you're talking about efficiency and effectiveness, because that's really super important about people being mobile. We can go and redo all these projects and be creating barriers for people from leaving poverty to becoming prosperous, from being able to move about and have the mobility, whether they're 8 or 80. Can you talk a little bit about the movement of MnDOT to create efficiencies and effectiveness, to create projects that address community needs up front, the technical, as well as the technical and the environmental issues up front, so we end up with the best project possible at the end, where there's mobility for everyone, no matter how old you are, how young you are, how much you make, how much you don't make, that we have projects and we look and we say, wow, this is what we're talking about, a real system that meets the needs of the millennials who we want to have come here, because that's where businesses are creating businesses, and that we want to be the community in which we want Minnesota to be. Can you explain how you're changing the system to make that happen?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Mahoney. You stated maybe the best, that in viewing financial effectiveness, it really is about taking not as a narrow a view as a particular highway or a bridge, to kind of look at the entire system, and that knowing that if we make these investments, we have to make them for a generation. So let's get them right, and rather than we could build barriers or we could build links, and so clearly being thoughtful about integrating the multimodal approach early on in the planning is, I think, in the long term more prudent. So we obviously have scarce resources, so we aren't able to do everything that we want to do, but to at least think thoughtfully, rather, because ripping something up or cutting off economic opportunities for citizens is more costly in the long run. So I think your comment and certainly our approach and our evolving approach at MnDOT is to be more holistic and multimodal, and that is not a contradiction to being financially effective.
Right, exactly. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Zelli, I'm curious about the first slide on page number 3. With some of the testimony that we've heard today that our federal funding might come to the point where we only get partial payments for states' roads and bridge projects, as a policymaker, I'm concerned because those funds would be impacted right away. And you talk about it in long term. Even if we can get some general funding from the Congress to move into that particular account, that's certainly not long term and it's not sustainable. So what is the plan from the state level, from your department position, on what does that process look like for us to be able to set policy that is going to handle that kind of situation?
Commissioner Zelli.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Senator, I think that's there's two sides of that question. One is, if there is a shutdown of government, a shutdown of federal transportation, that we have to make sure we have enough reserves and capacity to manage our way through a short-term shortage of funds. And I think we are looking at ways, and we do have enough kind of reserves within the Trunk Highway Fund, within our agency, to kind of manage a very short-term process, so projects do not stop. That's kind of the quick question. But we wouldn't be able to sustain that over time without a great reduction in our program. So I think short-term, I feel confident that we could withstand a hiccup, and I think that's being just prudent management. But the long term, we know that states at the state level are taking more responsibility for a project, whether it's a large capital project or just operations. And we're also trying to, and I speak for other states as well, trying to advance our own innovation and our own flexibility in terms of using funds to ensure that we're not getting ourselves into promised hole. Promises that we can't keep and financial holes. I think projecting a level amount of federal funding may be viewed by many as optimistic, and of course we'll see, but I do think that the federal government will be in the transportation business. I think it's too important for us nationally, and there's certainly a lot of pressure on Congress to not drop what is ultimately a bipartisan issue, infrastructure. So I'm hopeful that we'll be at least at that level.
Thank you. And then Representative Earhart, and then we'll move on to the public testimony.
Mr. Chairman, there actually was a bonding debt service in effect prior to the current one. I have a letter in my files on that. And then I think Pawlenty wanted to bond his way to the presidency with the transportation circumstances here, and so there were some changes made. I just want everybody to know that.
Okay. Thank you for the information. Okay, well, I really want to appreciate, I really appreciate, Mr. Zelli, your time, your insights, and we'll obviously be in contact throughout the session, and you know, we'll probably have you back a couple times, at least on the House side, I'm sure on the Senate side. Various other issues we have to deal with MnDOT on as well. So thank you again.
Thank you, Chairman Hartstein. Thank you, committee and committee members. We'll look forward to engaging more in the session.
Yeah. Thanks again. Now, if the public would like any of your information, Commissioner Zelli, is that available as well, these charts, et cetera?
Yes.
So, okay.
Mr. Chair, this presentation
Senator
is
–
thank you, Mr. Chair. This presentation is on the Senate committee website.
Okay.
If folks want to take a peek there.
Okay, good. All right, well, let's move on to our public testimony. And members of the public and members of the House and Senate, I would like to try to get through this within an hour. That means that members of the public should keep, I don't want to short shrift any of your points, but really try to keep it around that 3 minutes per presentation. And members, if you have a question, obviously, please feel free to ask it, but let's also make the Q&A as crisp as possible as well. So our first testifier on the list is the mayor of Shakopee, Brad Tabke. Is Brad here? Right. Please state your name and title for the committee, and welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Brad Tabke. I am honored to be the mayor of Shakopee and honored to be here to speak with you today. So thank you very much for having me. I'm glad to see Shakopee so well represented, Representative Beard and Senator Pratt here today. So my portion of the testimony today is to talk about how the investments have affected the city's through the state of Minnesota. In 2008, wisely chose to invest in the 169-494 interchange, and directly because of that investment in the city of Shakopee through 2018, we will have, on the conservative side, over 4,500 jobs, nearly all brand new jobs, coming to the city of Shakopee and the surrounding region through 2018. And none of this would be possible without that direct investment in transportation that was done at 169 and 494. So I want to thank you for that, and that has had direct impacts in job creation, economic development in Shakopee, as well as a few other places. We have a lot of companies that are moving to Shakopee from and growing from out of state, and also moving to Shakopee and growing their company within the state as well. And so we have Shutterfly is coming to Shakopee. They'll be open around the 4th of July is when they will open up their new large high-end manufacturing production plant. With that, my good friend, the mayor of Bemidji, Rita Albright, she had called me a few weeks after the Shutterfly project was done, and they Shutterfly is investing in a call center in Bemidji as well. So these investments that are happening in the city of Shakopee and the state of Minnesota are having effects all through the state, and I know multiple stories that are happening the exact same way because of that similar thing as well. I had a meeting on Friday morning with an entrepreneur who is opening two brand new businesses in historic downtown Shakopee because of all the investment and all the work that's getting done in our area. It is bringing back the main streets. We are working really hard to get that and investing in it as well, but businesses are wanting to grow and come to our community because of the investments that are made. And it's not only the city of Shakopee that can say this, but Brooklyn Park and Eden Prairie and all throughout the metro and the state. These investments in transportation are key for helping us grow and continue to move forward with economic development in the state. As well, the city of Shakopee has very much supported the transit investments and the sales tax, metro-wide sales tax as well, for transit investments, because we know and believe that is part of the future and where we're going, and being able to get commuters and people back and forth, especially across the Minnesota River, in our specific case, is key to having transit options and giving people opportunities to get off the road so that small businesses throughout the metro, and like mine, I'm a small business owner, are able to utilize those lanes of transportation to get to work and to get to projects that are happening on a day-to-day basis. So I just want to say thank you for that investment you made in 2008 and promote and push for continued investment in transportation to have other projects that result in, like what we were seeing in Shakopee, with 4,500-plus jobs that are coming to our community. So thank you very much. I'm not sure if there are questions.
Thank you very much, Mayor. I appreciate that. Questions for Mayor Tapke? Okay. Appreciate it. Thank you. So we have Cynthia Pick, and then after that, Councilmember Russ Stark. I don't know if you want to come up together or not. That's possible as well. Oh.
Russ. Chris.
Oh, I see. Okay. No, yeah. I think you're on the next panel, council member, so I misread that. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Cynthia Peach. I'm the Transportation Programs Director for Tri-Valley Opportunity Council. We're a nonprofit community action agency based out of Crookston, Minnesota. I'm here this morning to talk to you a little bit about our transportation program and what we've done in the areas of economic development. Right now, we provide public transportation services in 7 counties in Northwest Minnesota, and we do day-to-day service in Crookston, Thief River Falls, and Bagley, Minnesota. Other things we do are rural trips for individuals that need to get goods and services that aren't available in their own rural communities. We have commuter routes for DigiKey employees, as well as we shuttle students from the Northland Community Technical College campuses between East Grand Forks, Minnesota, and Thief River Falls. We also have a bus that provides shuttle services for the University of Minnesota Crookston students and employees. We provide daily rides to people to go to work, training, shopping, medical appointments, and to access other resources that may not be available in their home communities. We provide access so those citizens can continue to reside in their rural communities. We also have a volunteer driver program. We serve about 7 to 8 counties in Northwest Minnesota. We have 100 volunteer drivers, and those volunteer drivers provide transportation services for citizens that can't get on public transportation or can't access public transportation when they need it. One of the things that we have noticed is with county social service agencies such as Polk County, we save them in the area of $80,000 to $100,000 per year, so they don't have to hire staff or have their staff be transporting the clients to different appointments that are necessary. Our service area consists of 77,657 miles, and we have a population in our 7 county area of 84,392. The number of rides that we provided in 2012 saw a 9% increase compared to that in 2011. In 2013, there was a 15% increase in the number of rides compared to 2012. You'll remember that in the 70s, transportation wasn't public transportation, as you had remarked earlier. Transportation was for senior citizens and for disabled individuals. We're now public transportation. We want to provide access to everyone in our areas from birth to death. We take employees to work on our commuter routes. With funding from MnDOT, we had the opportunity in 2013 to start to provide employees working at DigiKey Corporation in Thief River Falls the opportunity to ride the bus. This business employs 2,800 employees in the city of Thief River Falls. If you're familiar with Thief River Falls, you'll note that it has a population of 8,661 people. One-third of the population of Thief River is what they need for the workforce at DigiKey. DigiKey is an electronic distribution center. They are the 4th largest electronic center in North America, and they are the 6th largest in the world. Tri-Valley gets people like this to work every day. Right now, we're providing transportation services from East Grand Forks to Thief River Falls and from Crookston to Thief River Falls, so DigiKey employees get to work. We think it's environmentally friendly. Instead of putting 20 to 30 cars on highways, we're putting one bus that can carry approximately 35 to 45 people. But we don't have the resources to provide enough to provide the bus service for their second shift because they are a 24/7 operation. We worked hard to make our routes more efficient and more effective. Our priority is public safety and transportation access for our community members. I'd like to take the opportunity to thank you from the state of Minnesota from the funding from the local and state leaders, which has recognized the need for public transportation and continue to provide access for our citizens so they can go from place to place. I'd be happy to take any questions if you have any.
Thank you, Ms. Peach. And sorry, I mispronounced your name at the beginning. Okay, thank you again for coming such a long distance to be with us today. So our next, we have two folks that I might understand will appear together, Council Member Russ Stark and Mr. Ferguson. So welcome to the committee, and please state your name for our record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairs and committee members. My name is Russ Stark. I have the pleasure of representing the northwestern part of St. Paul on the City Council, and I've been doing so for a number of years now. The state's $96 million investment in the Green Line over the last several years, as you know, has leveraged over $860 million in other sources, creating well over 5,000 construction jobs along that line. And some of you have probably heard these numbers, but just, I think they bear repeating because the impact has been tremendous. And that's just over the last 3 years. Since construction began, we've had over $1.6 billion in construction permits pulled along that corridor. Before we've got a single train in operation. And I can tell you that in my ward alone, and my ward represents about a quarter of the line, the number of planned developments that have not pulled permits yet is really tremendous. We're really seeing a great response in terms of interest and investment in the corridor based on the region's investment. So I wanted to thank all of you for that 2008 infusion of investment into the transportation system. It really is what made, in part, the Central Corridor go, certainly at the time that it did, as well as the bonding that was required. With a projected 42,000 rides per day in 2030, the Green Line will serve more people than any other transit route in the state. It'll help people who live and work along the corridor to get to work faster, to get to more destinations, and it's already starting to draw thousands of new residential units as well as jobs to that corridor, creating an environment where people can much more easily get back and forth to work and to the services that they need. While the heavy period of construction was difficult for small businesses along the corridor, a partnership between us at the city, the Metropolitan Council, and others has really been able to mitigate the worst of those impacts. And the net result today is that we've got a couple more businesses on the avenue than we did pre-construction, which we're really proud of. The project is beginning to be transformative for the communities along the corridor before the trains have already started operating. Small businesses are reinvesting in their storefronts. We've seen housing developers lining up to build along the corridor, such as the $45 million expansion of Episcopal Homes. We've seen other companies, such as Surly, desire to relocate and be on the corridor. A number of new businesses, including microbreweries, opening up just in the last year. National developers who were not paying attention to us in the past are suddenly interested in the corridor. We just had a Bay Area-based developer invest in two buildings totaling 750,000 square feet just off the corridor for reinvestment and invigoration of that area. The old Snelling Bus Garage site at Snelling and I-94, which has been sitting vacant for about 15 years, is suddenly drawing national interest from developers, local and national. As you may know, Sears has announced just down the street a major reinvestment in housing and retail adjacent to their property. You also probably know that the corridor bisects one of the Met Council's newly identified racially concentrated areas of poverty in the Frogtown and Summer University neighborhoods. And with a lot of investment happening in those neighborhoods along University Avenue, paired with other kinds of important work, we're also creating pathways out of poverty for folks living along this important corridor. I hope you've already had a chance to see some of the great things happening on the corridor. If not, I certainly invite you to come out on Saturday, June 14th for opening day and opening weekend. There will be some other people out there, so be prepared for some crowds. We look forward to that. And I also urge you to think about some additional investment in transportation and transit this session. I know that a lot of needs around the state, but I really think that these investments go a long way to making our state more competitive in the global economy. So thank you very much, and I look forward to hearing your questions. And otherwise, we'll introduce a friend and colleague, Chris Ferguson, who's a business owner on the corridor.
Thank you. Are there any quick questions for Councilmember Stark? Thank you very much. Mr. Ferguson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Please state your name for the record.
Chris Ferguson, President and CEO of Bywater Business Solutions. Just a little bit quickly, I've been fortunate enough through my career to work for some of the largest companies in the world, and I've lived in Toronto and New York and now call Minnesota my home, and own a couple of small businesses on Central Corridor, or the Green Line as we're now calling it. And I think what's important about some of the transportation investments is understanding, as businesses big and small make decisions about where they locate their businesses, how important it is not only to get your people to your offices, but also to get the goods and services that you produce out of those locations and deliver them to your customers. And, you know, what's interesting is, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, there was a large global trend to outsource and offshore jobs from places like Minnesota. And I think there's an opportunity with some of the changing demographics and some of the changing cost structures to bring some of those jobs back. But without a good infrastructure to bring people to those jobs and to deliver the goods away from those factories or people that would want to locate those jobs here in Minnesota, I think we'll miss that opportunity. So I think, you know, when we look at the 2008 spending and the light rail construction that happened, we're able to connect a lot of people to jobs through that light rail corridor. And then hopefully, as a resident of Eden Prairie, we can see the Southwest Corridor one day be built and connect people to the many companies that are out there, or the residents in Eden Prairie to downtown Minneapolis and downtown St. Paul. So I think it's as a business owner, I can say it's very important to understand not only what's happening today, but the future, because we don't make, you know, business investments for today. We're making business investments for a decade or two down the road. So understanding what that landscape looks like, understanding the state's willingness to invest in that infrastructure is incredibly important. Just one quick side note, I started my career as a union laborer on construction and the working end of some of these asphalt crews. And I can also say from that end of the perspective how important it is to have those jobs and people with good paychecks to be able to go and spend money in businesses like ours and other businesses up and down the Central Corridor. So it works on both ends, and it's incredibly important to make that investment.
Thank you very much. Questions for Mr. Ferguson? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And now we have Janelle Waldock, and after Janelle, Audra Chaneman and Aaron Lembrecht will come up. I appreciate all the testifiers' pointed and crisp testimony.
Great. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Janelle Waldock, and I'm the director of the Center for Prevention at Blue Cross and Blue Shield of Minnesota. And I'm here today testifying as part of the Move Minnesota Coalition, which Blue Cross is a part of. So you may ask why Blue Cross is part of a transportation coalition. The reason is simple. While transportation solutions such as bike and pedestrian options are not, of course, the silver bullet to Minnesota's healthcare conundrum, they do need to be part of the solution. Your colleagues in Health and Human Services, I'm sure, would echo our sense of urgency on the status of health outcomes in Minnesota, particularly the disturbing research that estimates that the current generation will have a shorter lifespan than their parents. We see working with a diverse group of non-traditional stakeholders advocating for transportation funding as not just critical to job growth and economic opportunities, but moreover, good for the overall health of all Minnesotans. At Blue Cross, we strive to make the healthy choice the easy choice. I'm sure you're well aware of the many benefits that come with bike ped options, including safety, access for people with disabilities, as well as making communities just generally desirable, a factor supported by the public in a recent survey showing that 93% of Minnesotans believe transportation projects should accommodate walkers and bikers, as well as motorized vehicles. But our expertise, as you would expect, is in the healthcare world. And with that in mind, I'm going to speak to the implications of obesity in our state. Obesity levels in Minnesota have jumped from 15.3% in 1995 to 26% in 2012. By 2020, projections suggest that figures will see nearly 1 in 3 Minnesotans classified as obese. So why is this such a problem? Unfortunately, obesity brings with it increased risk of substantial chronic health problems. The CDC reports risks for type 2 diabetes, heart disease, and many cancers. These problems will add a projected $3.7 billion to Minnesota's annual health care costs by 2020. As you can imagine, these figures, these are figures that both keep us awake at night as well as drive the work that we do at Blue Cross. The good news is that we know many of the solutions to curbing this epidemic, and a big part of that is increased physical activity. Health experts such as the Centers for Disease Control, the U.S. Surgeon General, and the World Health Organization all agree and recommend physical activity, including walking and biking, to prevent chronic diseases and improve long-term health. They also recommend that communities and states pass local ordinances that build environments that encourage activity. This view is supported by Minnesotans, with 87% of people believing that the way a community is built has a big effect on how much physical activity they get, a sentiment shared in both the 7-county metro area and in greater Minnesota. We feel that it is crucial that Minnesota continue its commitment to comprehensive transportation funding, and that included in the package is long-term sustainable funding for bike and walk community connections. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for your time today. I'll answer any questions you have and be available as a resource as you continue this discussion. Thank you.
Questions for Ms. Waldock? Appreciate your work a lot. And now we're going to hear from some people from some specific corridors that want to talk about issues around funding. So is Audra?
Mr. Chair, this is Gary Schoquist from.
Okay, I don't have Gary on my list. I apologize. You could make a quick statement. That would be great.
My name is Gary Schoquist. I represent Quality Bicycle Products, the nation's largest bicycle parts distributor located in Bloomington. I just have a couple of quick points. Bicycling access for our company is critically important. We've been able to demonstrate a 4% decrease in healthcare savings because our cyclists can get to work. Imagine if that was the case in another 100 companies in Minnesota. Second, our decision to build, we have a facility in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and for 2 years we've been renting there and trying to get them to increase and improve bicycle access. They would not play ball with us, and so we decided to spend $8 million in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, so that our employees can cycle safely. So bikes mean business, certainly in that sense. Third, we're a bicycle company. Bicycle is our middle name, so you would guess that we are concerned about bicycling. But we're also the nation's largest distributor of bicycle parts. We have up to 300 deliveries a day into the building. On a busy day, we'll ship 10,000 boxes UPS. On a slow day, we'll send 3,000 boxes UPS. A tremendous volume gets in and out of the building that comes to the airport or from wherever to our building. We desperately need safe roads, solid bridges, intersections that work, and relief from constant construction, if at all possible. And then finally, I will make the point, the competitive advantage of cycling and transit. Whether you know it or not, you are in a race with other states. The young, the best, and the brightest are going to make decisions about where they come to live and work. To them, it's critical that they have cycling and transit options. They will not come to live here if they cannot have those things. I don't just mean the Twin Cities. I mean Rochester, Bemidji, Austin. If you're not getting this message already, you will. So you need to have this competitive advantage if you want the best and brightest to come and live and work here in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry I didn't have your name on the list, but I appreciate it, Mr. Schoquist. Yes, Representative Mahoney has become quite a bike advocate lately.
Well, thank you. I actually have, and I've heard about this fellow's company quite a bit, but that is what one of the I am continually shocked by my children's friends who don't have cars but have bicycles, and they're biking during the winter even, which always surprises me. So this bike ridership, although it's not something that my generation did or I would do, but apparently it's okay to bike in 10 below weather, and he's correct. We do need to bring these best and brightest to our city and our state, and we have to figure that piece out.
Thank you. I hope Mr. Powell assured that we bike in 10 degree below weather. Okay, thank you. And now we have Ms. Shaneman and Mr. Lembrecht, I believe. So welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Audra Shaneman. I'm the president and CEO of the New Ulm Area Chamber of Commerce. It's nice to see some familiar faces. Appreciate the opportunity to speak again today. I do have some handouts if someone could help me distribute them to the members of the committee. New Ulm is a community. We're here in support of Highway 14, which many of you are familiar with already. New Ulm is a community of 13,500 citizens. We are home, thank you, home to Herman the German, Landry State Park, Martin Luther College, and the second oldest family-owned brewery in the nation, Shell's. Our major industries are agriculture and manufacturing. The Chamber, the New Ulm Area Chamber of Commerce, represents 340 members, 2,200 full-time employees in New Ulm and the surrounding area. At the New Ulm Chamber, we interview a portion of our membership every year, got to stay in touch, and Highway 14 is a consistent concern to a great many of our members. Because of this concern, the Chamber Board is very supportive of the efforts of the Highway 14 partnership and has created a New Ulm Highway 14 task force to make sure our community's voice is heard. We offered to our 340 members the opportunity to financially contribute to the Chamber's efforts on Highway 14, and we had almost 60% of our members contribute. From small retail shops to law firms, restaurants to construction companies, Highway 14 is a huge concern to our business community. In 2013, we brought Governor Dayton in October and Commissioner Zelli in November to meet with business leaders and owners about Highway 14 and hosted a roundtable with our legislators to hear from our business leaders how the current condition of the road directly impacts their business. The handout that I passed out today is a review of some of the comments that we've heard in these various meetings. I've included the contact information of our business leaders that participate. If you want to, feel free to contact them for more information. New Ulm is a center of commerce. It is the county seat of Brown County. 3M, Kraft, Firmenich, Parker Hannifin, Spexis, and Windings all have production facilities in our community. We also have many trucking companies like J.R. Shugel and DNA Trucking. The New Ulm Medical Center, with its affiliation with Allina, has recently completed $5.3 million renovations that include a birth center, cancer center, and clinic expansion with retail pharmacy to accommodate their growth. We are a growing community with good jobs and a wonderful quality of life. Today we are asking the legislature to recognize the important role that regional centers of commerce along Highway 14, like New Ulm, contribute to the state's overall economic success. We are a center of commerce, but we are not an island. We must be safely and efficiently connected other centers of commerce. Highway 14 is a corridor that connects New Ulm's products and people to Nicollet, Mankato, Rochester, the metro area, and beyond. Here's some of the impact Highway 14 has on our business community. Associated Milk Producers Incorporated produces award-winning butter, has its corporate office in New Ulm, 270 full-time employees, and $300 million in sales from the New Ulm plant. A plant in Rochester has another 80 employees and generates sales of $200 million from butter. The New Ulm plant alone has 1,000 trucks coming in and out every month. All of the AMPI facilities regularly use Highway 14 for transporting raw materials and finished product. Safety and efficiency are their big Highway 14. That's your sign. Beacon Promotions, a local promotional items company that employs 125 people, ships out approximately 80,000 orders a year and receives shipments on a daily basis. They report that Federal Express and some other freight carriers have refused to come to New Ulm because of the two-lane access of Highway 14. J&R Shugel, a large trucking firm in New Ulm, paid over $1.5 million last year in fuel, income, and license taxes. They would like to double their fleet, but it's difficult to bring in and recruit talent because of this roadway. It's estimated that approximately 1,000 trucks are dispatched out of New Ulm daily. These trucks are traveling on Highway 14, which is New Ulm's primary route to I-35 and I-90. Ken Lombrecht of KDB Services has been in the trucking industry for 35 years, has 10 trucks, 15 employees. His company runs trucks from New Ulm to Indiana and states that his drivers have found ways to avoid Highway 14. He believes that the condition of Highway 14 is a hindrance to the manufacturing industry in New Ulm. On the economic development side, we hear from site selectors
They like our location, they like our workforce, they like our economic environment, but they require a four-lane access. The current condition of Highway 14 knocks New Ulm off the list for potential development or expansion. We are here today to encourage investment in the transportation infrastructure in southern Minnesota, especially when it is attached to incredible economic opportunity. New Ulm is experiencing economic growth, and we do not want to be held back by Highway 14. Please continue the support of the Corridors of Commerce program, which has funded some of the upcoming projects on Highway 14. Thank you for your time. If anyone has any questions?
Thank you, Ms. Shanneman. I do have one question from Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for coming, Ms. Shanneman. There's been discussion today about the support of the business community for improved funding for roads and transportation in Minnesota, and I've noticed that the New Ulm business community has been quite outspoken about recognizing the need for new funding. Can you comment on that and explain some of what you've done to support that concept in New Ulm? Thank you.
On the topic of new funding, this is definitely a conversation we have, and it doesn't go very well sometimes. Because this project, if we pull it out of the whole scheme of things, New Ulm's been waiting for Highway 14 for a long time and hasn't really felt like a priority. So I think an overall funding increase, they're kind of thinking, well, we'd like to see something before we can say yes to anything. But we have had the governor and we have had the commissioner to our town, and they have laid out clearly the need for infrastructure investment. And I can't speak for every member, but I think we had to be realistic and go, okay, if we want progress, there may be some increases in that. But I think the governor and the commissioner did a great job of laying out the big picture. We're a little focused on Highway 14, maybe a little narrow on that. It's a big deal to our community, but we understand that we're a piece of a much bigger picture.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony and for the question, Representative Johnson. Mr. Lambrecht, welcome, and please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Aaron Lambrecht. I'd like to thank you guys all for hosting us this afternoon. I'm the president and co-owner of Shelter Products Incorporated out of New Ulm. We're a wholesale building material distribution center. We distribute to 7 states. We own our own fleet of trucks. As Audra stated, we're here primarily on the basis of the Highway 14 corridor and the impact that it has on our community and our businesses. New Ulm is the last time I had heard, the largest per capita number of trucks located in a single community in the United States, which is a pretty major statement. That group of owner-operators pay a tremendous amount in taxes, and part of why we're frustrated with the need for increased revenues for all the investment that's been made over the past years. For my business, the impact of Highway 14 is that the majority of manufacturing comes from the eastern part of the United States, and therefore I pay a higher cost on all incoming goods because of Highway 14 and its poor infrastructure. We don't really have many other options for coming from the east, so we get penalized for that on every truckload that we bring in. On a larger note, there's a significant investment occurring in Rochester for the investment in medical and in creating a medical corridor throughout southern Minnesota. That creates a growing demand and therefore growing traffic needs on Highway 14. Also, Walmart Distribution has announced that they're adding a distribution center in Mankato. I'm not exactly sure on the completion date, but it's not too far down the path. And they're going to be adding a ton of trucks, both inbound and outbound from that facility, adding to greater demand to Highway 14. And finally, FedEx just announced that they're going to add a distribution center in Mankato as well. So that's just a tremendous increase in the number of trucks on an already heavily traveled road that hasn't been supported. I want to just talk a little bit about the future of the state of Minnesota, and while it is advantageous for me to see Highway 14 be completed from New Ulm to Rochester, I think that it's important to take a broad spectrum look at the state of Minnesota, in that we talk about driving revenues. What do we do to drive revenues? And one of the things that I think that would be an easy way to do that is to grow jobs, create opportunities, add to the population of small communities like New Ulm and the greater state of Minnesota, rather than just charging the people that are here more. Also, when I look at my business, we're growing quite fast, and being in the building materials industry, we've had a couple of very tough years here as the national economy has been very stagnant, and we're recovering now and growing quickly and would like to capture more business. as we do that, we are forced to weigh the options of looking at other states to expand our business because, let's face it, we're in a very competitive environment, and what I need to do to make a prosperous business is slightly different than what my father did 35 years ago. So we're looking at states like North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wisconsin for expansion. I think that the state as a whole needs to show a commitment to transportation infrastructure to show confidence in the state of Minnesota. I, as a business person, am supposed to be confident in the economy of the state of Minnesota, and I'm supposed to be adding jobs and adding opportunities. I'd like to see the state as a whole make that same commitment and investment. I don't see that when I see the small percentage of bonding that has been discussed earlier. Finally, I guess I'd like to close with, as a business owner, there's many things that I can make decisions on as far as whether I participate in private or public sector commitments. However, with transportation, roads, bridges, I'm dependent on the state and federal government to provide these to me, and I need to see that as a priority for you.
Thank you very much. We have one quick question from Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Highway 14 has been kind of a lightning rod here for about 12 or 14 years I'm aware of, and maybe longer. So I'm just wondering if we ever complete Highway 14, the project there, if we'd ever see you back here again.
Well, I'm only 35 years old, and it's been talked about for over 50 years, so I can't answer directly, but I also feel the need to be a voice of the people, and so if there's another topic that my opinion would be valued on, I certainly would.
There's no shortage of issues in New Ulm, believe me.
Hey.
Because it's an improving community that we're going to make even better. Right. So, with that... Mr. Carney, I know that you want to testify, and I'm just going to make an announcement. We have several others who have contacted our office in advance to testify. Besides Mr. Carney, is there anyone else that wishes to testify? Okay, so Mr. Carney, we're going to have two more. So members, you're not up yet. We have four or five more people. I'm going to say that we're going to be out of here by one. So I really want to make sure that all the people that had the courtesy of calling in advance have the opportunity to testify for their 3 or 4 minutes. And if we have time, we will give a minute to Mr. Carney and a minute to the gentleman in the back at the end. So I would, again, remind everybody to please keep your comments as crisp as possible and members' questions as crisp as possible. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, no, we have Councilmember Sandahl, and Councilmember Hansen is after that. Welcome to the committee, Councilmember Sandahl, one of the great voices for transportation in the South Metro. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Chair Hornstein and Chair Dibble. My name is Suzanne Sandahl, and I am on the Richfield City Council. I also wear two other hats. I chair...
Great voices for transportation in the South Metro. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much, Chair Hornstein and Chair Dibble. My name is Suzanne Sandahl, and I am on the Richfield City Council. I also wear two other hats. I chair the 35W Solutions Alliance, and I'm a member of the 494 Corridor Commission. And we provided a map to you showing the particular interchange that both groups are very much interested in, and that is the 494-35W interchange. It was built any number of years ago. And just briefly, the Solutions Alliance is a joint powers agreement, as is the I-494 Corridor Commission. The Solutions Alliance represents three counties and seven cities. Our most recent addition was Elko New Market, which is 29 miles south of that interchange. But that shows you how important that particular interchange is, that they wanted to join our organization. 494 Corridor also represents five cities as well. The interchange, as you can look at it, is obsolete. It was built, designed in the late 50s and built in early 60s. Hasn't basically been touched in over 50 years. It is the 17th worst commute in the nation. The 35W is congested 3 to 5 hours of each workday. I-494 is congested 6 hours of each workday. The interchange also has the 8th highest crash rate in the state. It's a major transit corridor. We have 125 Metro Transit buses through the interchange,
every day, and we have 30% of Metro Valley Transit, the suburban ridership, through the corridor as well. The obviously, you know that construction costs will increase over time. This project has been in great need for many number of years. Some of the things that are impacted by the failure to develop this interchange includes the completion of the Orange Line BRT, the Lake Street project, the Knox Avenue alignment across 494, and the American Boulevard station in Bloomington, all still need to be done in order for the Orange Line to get full benefit for the members who would be able to use that particular line. Unless the improvements are made in the cities adjoining the corridors, will also continue to miss out on economic development. In Bloomington, the Pan-American transit-oriented design project is dependent on the Orange Line BRT being completed. Richfield's proposed 77th Street tunnel under the Cedar Avenue freeway was originally part of the I-494 EIS, and it's the missing piece of the ring road on the north side of 494 that would help complete that roadway. Because that particular piece was never built in Richfield, if you ever notice, the development is not anywhere near as complete as it is on the south side of 494 in Bloomington. Failure to connect with the airport and the Mall of America has very detrimental effects. Cities and counties up and down both corridors recognize that clogged arteries on our freeways discourage new development and job creation in our communities. An almost missed opportunity for Richfield was the Best Buy campus. When Best Buy intended to relocate, they looked at multiple different locations, and part of what they did when they were looking as to where they should locate was they did a pin map to show what was the travel shed for all of their employees. And it turned out that Richfield was in the center of that particular area, so that was to our benefit. But unfortunately, they also looked at the former Penn Avenue Bridge across 494 and said, we can't locate there unless you do something with that bridge. That will delay everything in terms of our employees. And with the assistance of Congressman Sable, we were able to build the 494 bridge across, the Penn Avenue Bridge across 494. That brought 5,000 jobs to the city and a major improvement for the state highway system. Its current funding methods and sources will not be able to meet Minnesota's needs. As a small business owner of a law office in Richfield, I have 5 employees, and I represent clients from all over the metro area. They come from surprisingly far distant suburbs. And one of the things my clients now do is they tailor their appointment times between 10 and 2 because they don't want to drive on rush hour on either 35W or 494. They know how slow it is. On behalf of the Corridor Commission, I-494, 35W Solutions Alliance, we ask that you pass a balanced multimodal transportation plan that meets current and future needs throughout Minnesota. Please fix funding for the long term.
Thank you very much, Council Member. Any questions? Thank you. And now we're moving a little even further to the south in the metro with Council Member Gary Hansen. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
By the way, Michael Myers is next, followed by Dorian Grilly. And again, for Michael and Dorian, please make sure that you can be crisp in your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Gary Hansen, Eagan City Council Member and Board Chair of the Suburban Transit Association. I appreciate the opportunity to speak just very briefly this morning on suburban transit opportunities and needs. We did provide 4 slides for you that I understand is in your packet. If you want to refer to those, I'll just quickly go over those in the interest of time. Our objective, of course, is to connect people to places, and that becomes increasingly important as our population grows. According to Metropolitan Council 2030 projections, population in the Suburban Transit Association provider service area is expected to increase by an average of 34% by 2030. And that compares to 27% growth in the region. Mayor Tabke earlier described how Shakopee has grown over the last several years, and we've also seen significant growth by other suburban communities. So as this growth continues, so will the need for transit services. A critical component of transit is connecting people to jobs. The Metropolitan Council 2030 projections indicate that employment in the suburban transit provider service area is expected to increase
by an average of 44% by 2030. And I think it's important to understand that not only do the suburban transit providers get workers to Minneapolis and St. Paul, but reverse commute routes provide transportation for employees to employers outside of Minneapolis and St. Paul. An example, Mystic Lake employs more than 3,500 people, many of whom commute from outside the area. Blue Express provides reverse commute opportunities for these employees. It's interesting to note that the populations of both the city of Eagan and the city of Plymouth increase during the day as a result of employees commuting to jobs within these cities. Senator Carlson and Representative Mason and I are excited about the opening of the new Paragon outlet shops coming up in on August 14 this summer. That is being developed, a total of 100 shops that are projected to employ about 2,000 people in that area. And they're being built near the intersection of Highway 13 and Cedar Avenue. So the Metro Red Line, Cedar Avenue bus rapid transit, we think is very important in helping to get people to and from that location, employees and shoppers as well. In addition to that, we have the City Council in Eagan has approved the construction of a hotel, as well as an apartment and retail complex. So we see opportunities for additional transit-oriented development in the area. And the Cedar Grove Transit Station, which is located right across the street and provides service to the Metro Red Line on Cedar Avenue, is going to be a very important part of that. The challenge that we have is that we need to find ways to improve connections to the Metro Red Line to get people in and out of there. And I think Representative Mason can tell you of some of her experience in making some of those connections. So, but that's just another example of the need for expanded transit in suburban areas. And finally, just want to point out that suburban ridership has grown significantly over the years. It has risen steadily from 1.5 million rides back in 1990 to more than 5 million rides by the end of last year. And that growth has continued in recent years. Suburban population and employment continue to increase, as I described, and that's driving ridership potentially significantly higher. So we have some needs there that we need to serve, and we certainly encourage consideration of the funding support of those needs.
Thank you very much, Council Member. Are there any questions? Quickly?
Can I just make one comment really quickly? This area where Paragon is opening used to be the major shopping center for the Eagan-Burnsville area. When 77 went through, it really cut off the access to the to that area. So it is incredibly important now that we have another major shopping center coming into that we have adequate transportation into that area. And we'll be talking about that in the future.
Thank you. And now we have Mr. Myers and then Mr. Grilly.
Good afternoon.
Thank you and welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
My name is Michael Meyer and I'm the chairman of the Citizens Advisory Committee for the Gateway Corridor. I'm also, as a result of the chairmanship, a member of the Policy Advisory Committee as well. The Gateway Corridor is an 11-mile stretch of road. I believe you have a handout. It's an 11-mile stretch of transit service that we'd like to develop that runs basically from 94 Manning Road, essentially, into the Union Depot into St. Paul. The challenge of not funding a Gateway Corridor, okay, is that this really provides the East Metro, if you will. It ensures regional balance and connectivity as the Twin City develops its regional plan, which was envisioned as 2030 plan. Without it, the East Metro is essentially cut off from the regional transportation system developed in that way. It's obviously going to be a thoroughfare for people to commute for jobs. For example, if you're a resident of Woodbury and you don't want to wait an hour and 40 minutes when it snows to get from work to, say, your job at Securian, you can hop on this and get there in 35, 40 minutes. If you're a resident of St. Paul and you need to get out to your job in 3M, again, you can get there in 15, 20 minutes. The primary reason for doing it, though, is we lack all-day access, regional transportation access between those two areas, if you will, from the Far East suburbs into St. Paul, and then by virtue of St. Paul, through the Green Line into Minneapolis. One of the interesting notes about this corridor is this is really about growth. This isn't about today. Obviously, it's about the vision and the growth that's going to take place. It's projected right now that 90,000 people will live in that corridor by 2030, or increase residence by 90,000 people by 2030. More interestingly, and probably more anecdotal, is the fact that, according to Thomson Reuters, Gen X, 25% of Gen X doesn't have a driver's license. So this mode of transportation becomes increasingly important as the 70% of people who have driver's licenses are currently over 70. So as you can see, as we start moving forward, this becomes an extremely important transportation, especially for the growth of the East Side Metro. And if you look at the aerial, which I don't have but I can provide for you, the aerial shows large swaths of land that are available for development. And this development is crucial if we are going to build a regional system that serves the entire metro region. And that's really
Thank you, Mr.
the comments
Myers.
That I have.
Thank you so much. Are there questions, Mr. Myers? This has been a very active group.
By the way,
appreciate your work.
I do sit on the Transportation Committee for the Chamber of Commerce for the City of St. Paul. I'm also on their PAC board. I'm also on their Public Advisory Committee.
Good.
And I don't want to steal their thunder, but they will be coming out in support of this and other regional transportation issues shortly.
Thank you very much. So we have Mr. Grilly, Mr. Hess, and Ms. Munt as well. It will be our last testifier, and then we have a couple quick ones from the public after that.
My name is Dorian Grilly. I'm the Executive Director of the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota, which is a member of the Move Minnesota Coalition. For most of our lives, we have focused on making the car the safe and easy choice. We very effectively and efficiently engineered physical activity out of our lives, and as a result, as you heard from Blue Cross Blue Shield, it's costing us dearly. I believe that we need to begin to reverse this trend and accelerate investments in order to make bicycling and walking a safe and easy choice for everyone. With comparatively minor investments, bicycling and walking could be a much bigger part of the solution to some of our society's most complex problems. And I'm not the only one that feels this way. I have letters of support from all around the state, but I chose Mayor Hank Ludtke from Frazee to show that it's not just Representative Bernardi and the city of Minneapolis that are bicycle and walking happy. Mayor Ludtke says it is imperative as we move to the future to have a diversified transportation network that not only provides for auto, truck, and freight needs, but mass transit and, of course, the need for a healthy, safe climate for the increased use of bicycles as a primary mode for individuals. People and communities all across Minnesota are well aware of the benefits of biking and walking and the benefits to the health of their communities and their economic competitiveness. I passed around the bicycle-friendly community handout. Yes. We have people from Grand Marais to Jackson, Baudette to La Crescent, all working on that, several dozen communities. And it's not hard to see that the demand for and awareness of the need to invest in non-motorized infrastructure is going up. Both MnDOT and Met Council are engaged in bikeway planning, and Met Council's plan calls for doubling the size of the existing metro bikeway system. Over 100 Minnesota communities are working to implement safe routes to school plans, and that map is the unfunded list of unfunded projects that I sent around. And the statewide health improvement program provides or includes the bike-friendly community and bike-friendly business programs as an approved health intervention strategy. And as noted on that map, we also have a growing complete streets movement around Minnesota. And one of the most popular things the Bicycle Alliance of Minnesota has done is to create a walking and biking safety curriculum for schools in partnership with Blue Cross and MnDOT. My staff literally cannot keep up with the requests from schools to train teachers and requests from communities and businesses to help with bicycle-friendly planning and implementation. Demand is just going to continue to go up, as you've heard from some of our other testifiers. And as you heard from Mr. Choquist at Quality Bicycle Products, they have proved that there are great benefits to biking and walking. The Bicycle Alliance is also working with some of our biggest international corporations that also want to be known as bike-friendly. They actively use Minnesota's bike-friendliness and the Twin City bike-friendliness in their efforts to recruit, as they said, the best and the brightest from around the world, and have made big investments in bicycling for their employees. Minnesota has more nationally ranked bicycle-friendly businesses than any other state but California, and we've just begun, I believe that. So, ironically, all this is going on when funding for non-motorized infrastructure is going down. I think you all know that problem. I won't go into the details. MnDOT's only been able to fund about 15% of the Safe Routes to School grant requests, and only a little bit more of the transportation alternatives requests, and they just cut the program, the feds just cut the program by a third. But there is significant public support for these kind of investments. A recent poll by the Minnesota Environmental Partnership confirms that by showing over two-thirds of those surveyed favor including bicycle and pedestrian funding in transportation projects. And MnDOT's omnibus survey even shows a greater level of support. So when someone asks me why I should do this or why we should be doing this, I always quote the same thing what some public health professionals refer to as the rule of fours. About 4,000 people in the United States die annually in bike and pedestrian crashes. About 40,000 die in motor vehicle crashes, and about 400,000 die of disease related to physical inactivity. So simply said, we need to be making investments that will not only fix our roads and bridges, but transform our transportation system to meet the needs of our growing and changing state and its communities. The Move Minnesota proposal will give us the tools and more resources to implement the vision of making bicycling and walking the safe and easy choice for
Thank
everyone.
You very much, Mr. Grilley. Any questions? Okay, we have, Senator Senjum, nice to see you.
Excuse me, thank you very much. I just have a question, maybe a more general one. What do you think the role of local government is towards pedestrian and bicycle pathways within a community? And then, Mr. Chair, maybe you can help me. Does the county wheelage tax option give communities a chance to consider the use of that tax for these kind of things?
Well, do you, Mr. There's two questions.
Yeah.
So,
and I'm not sure.
Mr. Grilley. Well, very quickly, Mr. Grilley, the role of local government in promoting bike.
Well, I think most of our local governments and the area planning organizations have been doing a great job of planning to include bicycling and walking in their future transportation infrastructure. They also, in the past, have been putting up a match to the federal program. So I think there is an important role for local contributions to these programs.
Thank you. Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Looking at my counsel. I think the question it depends. There's a couple of
the question on
the
wheelage
tax. Yeah, I think if bike facilities are part of a roadway improvement, I think the answer to that is yes. And if you also recall, Senator Senjum, we also gave counties the ability, and I think Olmstead did this to enact a local option sales tax for transportation purposes, and that. Those resources are available locally should a county opt to make bike and ped improvements.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So we have Mr. Hess and Ms. Munt, and then we will be very close to the end of our hearing. Welcome to the committee.
Thanks. Chair Dibble, Chair Hornstein, and members of the committee. My name is Russell Hess, and I work for the Laborers District Council of Minnesota and North Dakota. I represent over 10,000 skilled construction laborers who live and work all across Minnesota. The men and women of our union pour the concrete, rake the asphalt, and control the traffic on highway, bridge, and transit and bike trail projects in every corner of Minnesota. Today, my task is to put a human face on all the numbers that we've heard today. I'll try to do my best to do that. We're in favor of a comprehensive transportation funding package that will support the transportation system here in Minnesota. For our members, it's about putting food on the table and having a middle-class lifestyle. For tens of thousands of Minnesotans, our health care packages cover tens of thousands of people. I'm going to get rid of a bunch of this stuff here that I was going to say. And after listening to testimony today, just briefly, in 2006, our numbers, our work hours, we measure how our members are doing by the number of work hours they do. 2006, our numbers peaked with about 44,700,000 hours worked in highway and heavy. That's about 4,000 jobs. By 2009, we'd lost a third of those hours due to the recession and other issues. This year, we're back to the peak of 2006. Took us 7 years to get back to where we were. And for our members who are here today, who apparently they've heard me talk about this before, so they didn't stick around necessarily, the guys in the orange shirts, that's pretty scary to hear about the funding drop that's coming, because they don't want to go back to what it was in 2006 and 2007 and 2008. More practically, we could be facing what I call brawn and brain drain. As skilled construction workers leave the industry for more stable work situations, ultimately raising the cost and delaying a solution to the problem while we train a whole new generation of construction workers to do that work. What I really want to draw attention to is I live in Plainview, Minnesota, southeast Minnesota, Wabasha County. We have three what we would call highway heavy contractors in Plainview and in Elgin, the neighboring town. Probably 50, 60 jobs between those three small businesses. I don't know that the new Quick Trip in town can replace the $45,000 to $50,000 to $65,000 a year jobs of those three highway heavy contractors in my town. And those kinds of stories you're going to find in every county across Minnesota, whether it's a gravel pit, whether it's a contractor, whether it's a company that makes pipe is going to go in the ground underneath culverts. This is what we're facing across all of Minnesota. Everyone's touched by this. I have more I could say. I'm not going to. You guys can want more information about what we do, where you guys are. Let me know, and we'll get you some specific information about that. Thanks.
Mr. Hess, I want to just personally thank you for the large turnout of your members today and the fact that you've had a very consistent message to all of us about the importance of infrastructure and jobs. So thank you very much.
It's a good thing this wasn't in July, because none of them would have come. They'd have been home to work instead. Thank you.
Okay, our last formal testifier, and we have one member of the public who wants to speak for a minute, but our last formal testifier is Ms. Jennifer Munt. Thank you so much, Ms. Munt, for your work and for coming to the committee. We say
Chairman Hornstein and Dibble and Transportation Committee members, my name is Jennifer Munt, and I'm here today representing AFSCME Council 5. We're a union of 43,000 workers who advocate for excellence in public services, dignity in the workplace, and opportunity and prosperity for all workers. Our union is a proud partner in the Move Minnesota campaign, and we urge you to make transportation a priority this session. We join a diverse group of stakeholders who believe that now is the time to develop a 21st century multimodal transportation system. In Minnesota, transportation employs about 65,000 workers, including 2,700 AFSCME members who maintain and repair state highways and bridges. We help our communities dig out and get back on the road when winter weather hits. We inspect bridges and aging infrastructure to keep commuters safe. And we leave our families to rescue our neighbors whenever floods wash over our roads. There's no way our economy can grow, prosper, and compete on crumbling infrastructure. It's like a circulatory system that can no longer pump without proper repair and maintenance. Unlike new construction, our maintenance work is 100% state-funded. There is no federal match for plowing snow, patching potholes, and inspecting bridges. Today, I'd like to make the case for asset preservation. If you remember nothing else from my testimony, please remember three things that scream urgency. First, half of our roads and bridges are more than 40 years old and in poor condition. Second, nearly 2.5 million commuters drive across a structurally deficient bridge every day. And third, MnDOT has nearly 2,000 fewer maintenance workers today than it had a decade ago. With a shrinking workforce, it's increasingly difficult for us to keep up with our aging infrastructure. Much of Minnesota's transportation infrastructure was built in a short span of years, in the 1960s and 70s, so our roads and bridges are all wearing out at the same time. Take a look at a map of problem bridges, and you will see that every red dot shows a structurally deficient bridge. There are more than 1,000 broken bridges scattered throughout our entire state. They're in every single legislative district. AFSCME members see the underbellies of our bridges, the poor pavement on our roads, and potholes that could swallow a car. Maybe the public can't yet see the deterioration that AFSCME members see every day, but that doesn't make it any less dangerous. Government has a responsibility to make sure that bridges don't fall. In November, MnDOT closed southbound Interstate 35 in Duluth after our inspectors found a deteriorated piling on the roadway. That piling was so corroded that you could see right through it. The quick fix by MnDOT's repair crews had that stretch of freeway open in a week. Commuters were grateful that the problem was caught early before anyone got hurt. Commissioner Zelli learned that important lesson from the 35W bridge collapse that killed 13 Minnesotans. Last year, the legislature authorized $300 million in extra bonding for selected road projects called Corridors of Commerce. You added new lane miles, but forgot to budget for maintenance. That's been the pattern for the last decade. Growing our transportation system without plans to maintain it is like buying a new car and never changing its oil. It's time to budget for maintenance, and it's time to reinvest in MnDOT's workforce and buy new innovative equipment to properly maintain our roads and our bridges. Transportation is about opportunity for all, no matter who you are, no matter where you live. It's about keeping Minnesota competitive in job growth, workforce development, and quality of life. It's about safely connecting every Minnesotan to their next destination, whether it's to work, school, play, or family. We urge you to make transportation a priority this session. Our quality of life and Minnesota's economic vitality depend on safe roads and bridges and easy access to public transit in communities where people can walk and bike.
Thank you so much, and thank you for your ongoing work on this issue. Are there questions of Ms. Munt? Okay. So we have one member from, is there anyone else from the public? This isn't a bill. You know, normally when we do a bill, we ask for pro and con, if there's anyone from the public that wants to testify pro and con. But is there anyone from the public that just wants to very briefly address our general topic for today? Okay, we have Mr. Carney. And Mr. Carney, I'm going to give you 2 minutes. We have the House Transportation Policy Committee is going to reconvene in a little while, so we do need to vacate the premises and then reorganize. So 2 minutes, Mr. Carney. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name
for the record. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob again, Carney, Jr. from Minneapolis. We're heading toward a transit and a transportation session, obviously. And what I see emerging is kind of a coalition of the status quo. Everybody knows we need to do something, and there's a tremendous amount of organization to do something. But the mentality, to me, is very much the status quo. I am proposing to launch a transit revolution, and I will be here daily during the session talking with anybody who will talk to me about it. I wrote an ebook, 150-page book, last year laying out a plan for Minneapolis. This year I'm working on Inside the Beltway, 494, 694. One major idea there is five-minute service, so you cut the transit time tax. That's one thing that drives people away from transit. You have to wait too long for it. Let's make all the service 5 minutes. We're going to use Metro Mobility-sized buses. Is it going to be a jobs program? As far as the belt, the freeway system, think about this. On a cloverleaf right now, you cannot transfer from one route to another because you've got these loops. You've got merging traffic and weaving. I've just filed a patent application for a new cloverleaf design that makes it possible to transfer from one bus to another in a cloverleaf. I passed out some information laying out the summary of an alternative for the Southwest Rail Line. I just wanted to essentially give everybody notice. I'm going to be working on this, and I'm going to be sending you all emails and trying to advance a way of thinking about this that can build a new approach to transit and transportation in Minnesota and that can make this the basis of a global business. So certainly an audacious proposal, but this is what I'm going to be working on. I look forward to talking with everybody here during the upcoming session.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Carney. And thank you, members. Thank you, members of the public. I thought we had a very substantive hearing today. A reminder, and this is especially for people around the table, so we're going over to the Senate a week from tomorrow on the 18th. I know there's the Move Minnesota Coalition will be presenting more specifically their ideas. I want to invite, and this is for members of the committee and the public, your ideas for addressing some of the issues that have been raised today around transportation finance, other innovative things, ideas you have, both sides of the aisle. We, you know, our intention to hear a variety of ideas to address the needs that we have outlined today. And so Senator Dibble will be chairing that meeting, and so we want to, again, have a lot of diverse voices. Again, if there's ideas from the chamber and the other side of the aisle, we would like to entertain them, if not next week, sometime during the session. So we're really open to everyone's thoughts about how to address this very, very timely issue. So Senator Dibble, the last word goes to you, and you've got the home court next week.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just to announce the time, place of the meeting next week. It is for folks who don't know. It's Tuesday, February 18th. It's going to be at 1 o'clock in room 15 of the Capitol, and we'll post the agenda shortly. Also, members, just wanted to let you know that we are working with the Center for Transportation Studies on a topical presentation similar to what we had last year. Figuring out if it's going to be over at McNamara or over here at the Capitol. It'll probably be sometime during that first week of session in the evening with food. So stay tuned. It'll be really interesting.
Great. So, again, thank you to our members. Thank you to the public. And we look forward to an ongoing discussion about transportation issues this session. This informational hearing is adjourned.